South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very, very good morning across the Hill Country in San Antonio and South Texas and wherever you might happen to be listening on the internet. Absolutely beautiful morning out there this morning. And it's really starting to feel like spring. We're still waiting on those April showers to bring the May flowers. some folks got a real good rain in the past week, but those of us in the near hill country, you just have to say, well, maybe next time. But anyway, it is what it is, and it is a beautiful morning out there and lots of things to talk about. Don tells me we've pretty much got an open board, so last week the lines filled up in a hurry, and it was tough to get through. So if you've got a question you'd like to ask, comments you'd like to make, you know the number, 210-599-5555. It's just really starting to look like we are past any really chilly weather. I'm going ahead and recommending that you can plant just about anything you want, including periwinkles. And out of the vegetable garden, probably okay to plant your okra. That's one thing that you might think about holding off another week or two. But it is certainly time to plant all the usual suspects: tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, squash, cucumbers, bush beans, black-eyed peas, jicama. Have you ever grown jicama? That's kind of a fun plant to grow, and really grows very easily in this area. And just team that up with a good little Mexican lime tree to get the limes you needed. Oh, there are just so many things to do when it comes to gardening. And the flower beds, too. Lots of beautiful stuff out there and available to you. Angeloni is just really starting to be available in the nurseries. Same thing is true of Pentas, but there are nice plants out there to go along with the things that will get you up into the hot weather. If you want spectacular, you can still think about petunias and all, but they're going to fade out when the real heat hits, and hopefully that's going to be a little ways away. But lots of colorful things you can plant now that will go all the way through the summer. Not to mention all the, you know, all the beautiful perennials from the lantanas to, you know, 10 different salvias to Greg's Mist Flower, the Lindheimer's Gara. There's an awful lot of things to plant and a lot of things to talk about. So anyway, give me a call, 210-599-5555. And it's, you know, lots of other things showing up out in the yard, starting to see, or actually have been seeing, a bunch of June bugs. Some places around the area have seen quite a few in the hill country, a number of them here in town. If you're seeing June bugs, don't delay getting the beneficial nematodes out. Because if you're seeing June bugs, you can bet they're out there laying eggs that are what make the grub worms. And remember, it's not the great big grubs that do all the damage to your yard. It's the little bitty ones, the newly hatched ones. We call first and second larval instars. They did a huge amount of damage in this area last summer, and they'll sure do it again. You don't see the damage at first, but they cut the roots, and then it takes even up to 6 weeks before your yard really starts falling apart. So bottom line, hey, if you have seen June bugs around, it would be a really good idea to go ahead and get some beneficial nematodes out. So much for what I was going to talk about, because we now have Frank and Clint and Jack ready to talk. So I hate to keep people waiting. Don, let's just go to the phone lines and start with Frank. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
Hey, I got a question. I bought a house about 9 months ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was during, maybe you remember, last year's heat wave.
That's who I ever remember. Yeah, that was very memorable for anybody in the nursery business, let me tell you. We suffered as much as you guys did, but what went on with your house?
Well, it was horrible. They had planted sod. And I guess the builders weren't watering it properly, or I guess they just gave up on it. So when I moved in, everything was brown. When I tried to water it, nothing was sprouting. So I just let it go. And then now this year, all I have is nothing but weeds and a few squares of sod that are actually sprouting Bermuda grass.
Okay.
What can I do about it?
Is this a pretty sunny area?
The front yard is sunny. The backyard's in half shade, half sun.
Okay. Well, in your front yard, cheap and easy would be more Bermuda grass. If you want to plant from seed, it's barely time, but probably okay to plant common Bermuda from seed now, and you can probably do your entire front yard with $10 worth of Bermuda seed. So that is the fastest and cheapest way to go. You'll have to water maybe even a couple of times a day very briefly to keep that seed moist, but it will sprout. I think I'd probably go ahead and mow. Cut the weeds down. You don't have to till it or anything like that, but just mow the weeds down so that when you put your seed out, it will make good contact with the surface, and you'll have a pretty yard in a couple of months' time once that sprouts and starts to go. And Bermuda is certainly Bermuda is certainly the most tenacious and drought-tolerant grass. Now, if you have some St. Augustine out there that is still looking good, just keep on watering and fertilizing and let them fight it out. A healthy St. Augustine will choke out every grass known to man, including Bermuda grass. But, if you lost 90% of what was out there, rather than spend the money to put in more St. Augustine sod, not knowing what the weather's going to be this summer, if it were my yard, I just go ahead and seed with Bermuda. Now, backyard's a different story. Bermuda does not do well in the shade, so back there, you're probably, if you want grass, and think about that, you can have an awful pretty yard with a minimal amount of grass. You can put in some permanent perennials, give you color all the time. You can plant ground covers like Asian jasmine or vinca minor. There are lots of choices besides grass, but if you got pets or kids that need a grassy place in the backyard, Del Mar and Palmetto are still my two favorite varieties of St. Augustine for shady areas, and it's a matter of just, mow everything down low, put the sod in, roll it to take out any air pockets between the sod and the soil underneath, and you can do that, or if you're patient and have time and energy and don't want to spend as much money, you can always buy the sod and then chop it up into little 4-inch squares, and takes about a 15th as much sod to do it from plugs, but it's a lot of work. Back in the days when I worked for grass farming, when we planted grass, two of us in a day's time, if we were just laying solid sod, we could do probably 8 or 10 pallets of grass when we were chopping into little pieces and planting it that way. We were lucky to do 1 or 2 pallets a day. So it's a lot of work, but again, it's a lot cheaper. So whichever way you go, back there in the shade, if you want to go with grass, St. Augustine is going to be by far your best choice. But take a look at ground covers. Take a look at other options. It'll give you less to water and less to mow.
Okay, Bob. Back to the front yard.
Yes, sir.
What do I do with the existing sod that hasn't adhered to the underlying dirt underneath? Do I just go put to the seed on top of that?
No, pull that up and throw it in the compost pile. You want your seed to make good contact with the soil it's growing in. So wherever you've got those loose chunks, into the compost pile or into the trash can.
Okay. Now, do you recommend, as far as for the weeds, do you recommend a weed killer at all?
No. Mow them off. You mow them off and let your seeds start growing. Your grass is going to choke them out. Most all the weeds you see right now are winter weeds. Give us about 2 weeks of warm weather, they're going to turn brown and die anyway.
Okay. All right, Bob. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Well, congratulations on your new home, and don't hesitate to call me if you got any more questions.
Okay, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome, Frank. Thank you. Next in line is your friend Clint. Good morning, Clint.
Good morning. How's it going?
Oh, it's going along. Were you under one of those good clouds last week for a little bit of rain?
Oh, well, it wasn't a good cloud, but it's better than nothing. I got 6/10.
That's not bad. That's double what I got. But a friend in Seguin sent a picture of her rain gauge that had 3 inches in it. So once again, we can be jealous of everybody around it. But 6/10 isn't bad. That's enough to help the grass, not what the trees and shrubs and aquifers need, but that's enough to do a lot for your grass.
That it did, except the only problem, the wind come up and pulled about 1.5 inches of moisture out of the ground. It was so hard, so
it's always something, isn't it?
Went off the tree. snapped some of my jalapeno and other plants in the garden. So that was quite aggravating.
Yeah. Nobody said it was easy. And Texas is proving that we can be a land of challenges as usual this year. Just I'm ready for things to go back to, I'm not going to say normal, but back to typical, back when the weather was a little bit more predictable, when we got good rains on a regular basis, and we didn't have so much wind to worry about. But, you know, we'll tough it up and make the best of it. So what can I help you with today?
Calling on my asparagus. You let those go, and there's some of the stalks have just gotten so big and heavy they just fall over.
Uh-huh.
That was before the wind, anyway. So is it best to just leave them laying, continue to produce sugars, or should the ones laying down be trimmed out?
Anything that turns brown should be trimmed out. Anything that remains green, yeah, you're exactly right. Leave it there because it's still photosynthesizing. It's still putting nutrient back into the root system. So, yeah, watch it. If it's turning brown, clip it and throw it in the compost pile. If it's still green, just let it be.
Okay, and how long does it take for those little root beds to expand out that asparagus garden?
And when did you plant this?
I'm just coming up on my second year.
Yeah, it's already happening. You know, with the summer like we had last summer, things didn't grow like we would expect them to, but above the ground. But your roots base expanded a great deal because I know you kept it watered and fertilized. You know how to garden. And but it's, you know, by next year, it should be, you'll, the clump expands very slowly. I mean, if it grows outward an inch in a year's time, that's about all you can expect. You'll get, you know, twice or three times as many shoots to harvest next year, but don't expect it to turn into a forest overnight.
Okay. That would be nice, though, as good as asparagus is.
There's no such thing as too much asparagus, and gosh, it's so delicious. You know, lots of times I just snap it off and, you know, into the mouth before it even makes it into the kitchen. It's so tasty and so good. But, yeah, I'm with you. You just, I wish it grew faster. It doesn't. You can always plant more next January if you want a bigger bed to start with.
Right. Different item going on now. The newer version of the growing green, I think, was that alfalfa based?
No, it was based on meat byproducts, and quite frankly, we tried it, and the plants loved it, and the odor was horrific. So a lot of people went back to the original growing green. The new growing green had a higher nitrogen content to it, but when it got wet and set in the sun, it smelled like what it was, and that was rotting meat. So if you put that one out, I would take a vacation for a week or 10 days afterwards. But good product. Nothing wrong with the product at all. And, you know, it was double the nitrogen and still, you know, in a good organic form. But if you think the regular growing green has a little bit of an odor issue, this stuff was way above and beyond that.
Does anybody make an alfalfa-based?
Yeah, Nature's Creation is. Nature's Creation, they make one called Premium Lawn and Garden Food. They make a different one that, I don't know, they just call it turf food or something like that, that is manure-based. But their Premium Lawn and Garden Food is still alfalfa-based, unless they've changed something and haven't told me. But the Premium Lawn and Garden Food, I think you'll find, is pretty much all alfalfa. And yet it still has a good nitrogen content.
Okay. I thought that was the whole reason of them doing that, growing the different type of growing greens, get away from the stink.
Well, no, the reason was that people wanted more than 3% nitrogen in there. Not everybody understands that, you know, when you're using organic nitrogen in the cation form, that the plants get all 3% of it. You go out and buy some of this crud sold by the chemical companies, even if it's 20% nitrogen, your plants probably get 10% of it. So you're getting less fertilizer for your plants with much higher numbers than you are with the lower number like the original Manita Growing Green. And some people just wanted more nitrogen and still wanted it in, you know, good cation form. And that's why they went with it, because it probably does green things up faster. It does provide more nitrogen for the growth. But and maybe, you know, it might not bother you. But I have a partner with a sensitive nose, and she couldn't stand it. Boy, after I got a whiff of it, I went back to the old Growing Green. In fact, put out 3 bags of it last week, and, you know, it still has an odor to it, but that odor was gone in less than 24 hours. And so, you know, make your choice. They still sell both of them. Both of them are good products.
What percentage is that newer one?
I want to say it was like 7 or maybe even 9%.
Okay, so it's quite up there.
Yeah. Yeah, you can put it out on your coastal field, but I personally wouldn't put it up around the house.
Okay. Okay, well, I appreciate your time and everything.
Always pleasant to hear your voice. You get out and have a wonderful Saturday morning. I know we'll talk again.
Take care.
All right, Glenn, thanks so much. Next in line is Jack. Good morning, Jack.
Hi.
Hi there.
I live in the world's biggest poison ivy plantation.
Oh, and where is that? I thought I had that distinction.
No, I'm a little bit north of Bolverde. We've okay. lived here for several years, but I just waited till it got really, really hot, and I sprayed with a 20% vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
And did that about 3 applications and finally killed everything and just didn't
right.
do a thing. It never rained. It did anything. So how long before I can actually, if I use rubber gloves, pull that stuff up?
As soon as I go off the air at about 9 o'clock this morning.
What time do I expect you to help me?
Well, see, I have this little thing called the nursery, and this time of year, you know, my amount of free time during the day might be the 3 minutes that I sit down to inhale a bite of lunch. So it'll be dark before I'm ready to help, and I don't want to be pulling poison ivy in the dark. And just
I
as a just a note on that, way that you can make it less work next time is cut the poison ivy off first and let it sprout out from the base. And that way you're only spraying a small little patch instead of trying to spray a big plant. And it just takes a lot less of the spray. Probably the most important thing I will tell you is even dry and dead, that stuff, you do not want to burn it. The smoke would be highly toxic, could blister your lungs, so to speak. So once it's dry, it depends on how sensitive you are. I wear gloves. Since it no longer has any moisture, I may back to my elk skin gloves rather than having to worry about rubber gloves. But just put it in the compost pile or dispose of it. Do not burn it, because it.
I know my next door neighbor pulled all theirs up and was burning it. And I went over there, ran, and said, "Stop it!" You know.
Good for you.
So anyway, so as long as it's dry, it's probably okay.
Oh, absolutely.
It's wet. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well, that's what I did last time. I put the vinegar on it and let it dry out.
Mm-hmm.
And it got all kind of crunchy, and I kept spraying a couple of times and just went with a grubbing hoe and dug it up. But with all this rain and everything that we've had, it's...
Lucky you. Yeah, you've been under the right cloud if you truly have had good rains. And some people have had really good rains. I mean, Fredericksburg and even north of Bolverde, there's some hard rains came down. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm happy with the 0.4 inch we got, enough to do at least a little bit of good for the grass. But I'm very jealous of our Seguin friends and all that got 3 and 4 inches, and down south where they got big rains. We're still waiting on seeing a little bit more water coming down the Guadalupe and heading into Canyon Lake.
So what you're saying is find the bottom of it, cut it off.
Yeah.
Do I have to wash the cutters off?
You know, you're not likely to be in contact with the blade. So, my pruning shears, usually when I get through cutting anything, I may give them a little spray with WD-40 or something like that. But as long as you're not rubbing those blades on you, the toxin is in the sap of the poison ivy. So as long as you're avoiding any of that, and you know, I use long handle pruners that are probably, I was cutting cedar yesterday, as a matter of fact, probably 24 inches long. That was my after supper project yesterday. But no, you don't have to worry about cleaning those unless you just want to do so. Wouldn't hurt anything, but
wait a couple of minutes and then let it just kind of dry out, or let it maybe an hour or so, and then the sap.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, you have a beautiful nursery. I really enjoy going there.
Well, we do appreciate you coming to see us. Nobody ever has to buy anything to be welcome, but we always love the compliments. And as my partner's husband used to say, when people would say something like that, he'd look at him and say, "Well, it's not an accident." So we're blessed with a great staff, and I think most of us still have fun doing what we do. So appreciate you coming to see us.
Just let it spray them and let it dry out, and then cut it off, or cut it off first, and then let it dry out.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're spraying the big plants, you might be spraying something that's, at least if it's like it is on my ranch growing up post by my gate or something, it might be 6 feet tall and 4 feet wide. And, you know, stop and think about it. It takes a good deal of liquid to cover that much foliage. If I go in, and I do go in with my pruning shears and cut it off at ground level, it then starts sprouting out, and I've got a little clump of it that's 6 inches tall instead of 6 feet tall, and it takes a lot less spray, and actually, you know, that tender foliage dies even more quickly. So I'm just trying to make the work a little bit easier. You know, you're doing fine. You're getting rid of it, but if you could do the same thing with, a fourth the liquid and a fourth the energy, I suspect that your life is like mine. You can find plenty of things to do with that extra time.
Well, thank you so much for the time.
It's always a pleasure, Jack. Get out and have a great weekend, and I sure appreciate the call. Thank you so much. We're just a minute or two away from news here, so give me a call. You know, get in line for that little segment after the news. You know the number, 210-599-5555. We were talking about things to do, fertilizers. Again, if you haven't gotten fertilizer out within the past 90 days, really would be good to put it out. Organic products don't burn. They don't have to be watered in immediately, so it's not like you're using the synthetic stuff. But your plants are hungry, and fertilizer doesn't go to work instantly. It needs to be acted upon by microbes in the soil to put it into a form that's easily absorbable and usable by the plants. So get it out there. We are going to soon be beyond the time that you can safely put fresh compost on the yard. Once it gets real hot, we don't do that because the amount of ammonia gas it produces, it can actually do a little burning on your grass. So if you have the need, if your grass suffered from last summer's drought and this last January's cold, the single best thing I think you can do for it is put a quarter to a half inch of compost over it. But again, that window is about to close. One other thing I would mention, if you've been thinking about planting shade trees, and you're in the CPS Energy Service area, their green shade rebate program ends the end of this month. They want to see those trees planted before the end of April. And go to their website at CPS Energy. I think it's CPSEnergy.com. But there are a couple of suggestions on where you plant the trees. And there is a list of trees, but it includes all the good trees that we talk about. But anyway, they give you $50 credit per tree, up to 10 or 12 trees, something like that. If you plant 5-gallon trees, that'll just pretty much pay for the trees. And if you wait too much longer, though, you won't be able to do it. Right back after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
And you want to dial quickly because there is only one line left. Looks like, let's see here, Rosa and Steve and Robert all got in front of you. And I see no reason to put off going back to the phone lines because I love to talk to you about your questions. And Rosa is first in line. Good morning, Rosa.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was calling about my strawberries. They've grown real pretty. The plants are very pretty. The strawberries are big, and I'm waiting for them to get sweet. They never get sweet. Why do I have to put in there to make them be sweet?
What do you fertilize with?
Rose glow.
Okay, why don't you switch over and use some liquid, either like Hester Grow Plant or Medina's new liquid fish blend. I think you'll find that that will give you probably more growth as well as sweeter berries. Now, some of the sweetness is just dependent on the variety. Some varieties are, you know, sweeter than others, but I think you get a little bit more potassium. You get some things that are already in a liquid form, which the plants can use a little more quickly. So it's fine to use your rose glow, but use some of the liquid, either, like say, their Hester Grow Plant or Medina's Liquid Fish Blend. Alternate that with using your dry fertilizer, and I think you'll find your berries will get plenty sweeter.
Oh, boy, that sounds good. I was going to ask you, you were talking about poison ivy. What does it look like?
Poison ivy, gosh, once you've seen it, you never forget it. It has leaves that come out in a three-leaf cluster. You don't want to confuse it with some of the nice plants like, your Virginia creeper and Boston ivy and things like that. But it's a vine. It has reddish stems. The leaves are always in a cluster of three. And people that are allergic to it can really get sick from getting into it. Most people, you're just going to have the worst itch you've ever had for several days after you've gotten into it, along with a little bit of swelling and maybe even blisters. But you probably, if you have any of it, you'll know it fairly quickly. But it's very recognizable. Probably the best thing to do is, you know, Google just poison ivy or something like that. But it's the leaves, you know, imagine three leaflets. Some of them will be rounded. Some of them will have a little bit sharper points on the lobes. But it's always that three-leaf cluster coming out up and down the vine that makes it most readily identifiable.
Okay, well, because I have some out there, but I don't know if it's poison ivy or not. So I'll go look.
Well, don't go rubbing your hands in it to find out, please. I don't. I now, some people are not bothered by it. I'm knocking on wood as I say this. I have never had a problem with it. When I was a kid, my cousin and I used to climb way up in the grapevines to pick grapes for my grandfather to make jelly and juice with. And I know we climbed through it frequently, and my cousin got, you know, blistered and itchy, and for whatever reason it didn't affect me. So maybe you're one of those lucky people that can work around it but and not be bothered. But if you have it, you want to be sure that you're wearing nitrile garden gloves or something instead of leather, because the sap will soak right into the leather and stay there. And people who are susceptible to it, it can really deal you misery. What was that old song about you're going to need an ocean of calamine lotion? And truer words were never spoken.
That's funny. Okay. Just real quick, how about grapes? I've got a grapevine, and last year it had tiny, tiny grapes, and that's it. This year is going to be the second year, and I'm wondering if they're going to get bigger.
Well, it depends on the variety. We have a little grape that grows up in the hill country that always stays very small. They call it Black Spanish. The grapes are very, very sweet, but they're always, you know, down there not much bigger than an English pea. If you have one of the bigger varieties, and Champanelle is probably the best one to plant for a bigger grape in this area, you should get bigger grapes this year, but it might just be the variety. Or it might be the weather. You know, water deeply when you water, and, you know, some of those with the Rose Glow Plus, the Medina products will certainly give you the best chance. The other thing about grapes is they really need to be thinned out very heavily every winter before they start putting on their spring growth. You trim out. You don't cut the whole vine back, but you trim out, you know, even 80, maybe even 90% of the growth that's in there. And that means what's left behind will make much larger grapes. So thinning a grapevine in December or January, that's very important too, to get large grapes. So there's several different factors can influence that. Hopefully, in your case, it's just you needed a little bit more of a more mature vine, and you'll have good, nice big grapes this year.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You do the same. Thank you, Rosa. And speaking of strawberries, a big thank you going out to my friend Celso Garcia. I don't know if he won the Poseidon Strawberry Festival the way he did a couple of years ago, but boy, he brought by some absolutely delicious chocolate-covered strawberries. Celso, if you're listening, know that we really appreciate you, guy. Let's move on to the next caller, and that would be Steve. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have TIF 419 in my yard.
Uh-huh.
And I have this grass. It's called, I finally figured out what it is. It's called annual bluegrass. And it has a little bitty, it grows about, I don't know, 2 or 5 inches tall. And it is absolutely taking over my yard. And I don't know how to get rid of it.
Mow it off. Mow it off. Your 419 TIF has not really started growing yet. It's just, Bermuda is a hot weather grass. But mow the weeds off. Give your TIF 419 a little bit of fertilizer. And you give us about 2 weeks of really warm weather. That TIF will grow in and choke out whatever's left. That the bluegrasses, the rescue grass, the what people just call winter grass, all that stuff's going to die out when it gets hot. So you don't want to worry about setting your other grass back, spraying with something and getting it on the other. It's just Bermuda is always slow to come out. It's the last grass to come out in the spring, and we've had cool nights. In fact, even this morning it was a little warmer, but yesterday it was still chilly. So you just need some warm weather and little time. Just mow those weeds off. You absolutely do not have to spray. They're going to be dead with 2 weeks of warm weather anyway, and your TIF will come out and truly take over.
Okay, Bob. Thank you.
You're sure welcome. It's always a pleasure visiting, Steve. And let's go ahead and take one more call before we take a break, and that would be Robert. Good morning, Robert.
Hello there, Bob. I have a small area in my front yard of St. Augustine that is still very brown. It looks all more dead than alive. Anyway, is there anything I can do to try and get that to green up in that area? Or
I don't mean to be joking, but I would tell you you can paint it. Because if it's brown and dead, it's probably dead. Get down on your hands and knees and look real carefully. If the runners are brown, it's dead. It's not coming back. If the runners are still green, then you can put a layer of compost, maybe a quarter of an inch of compost over it and water it really thoroughly. But it ought to be showing by now. St. Augustine starts out a lot earlier than Bermuda does. You really ought to be seeing some green pretty shortly.
The area around it is green, yes.
Well, in that case, I would just put some fertilizer, put some compost on, and the new runners, which will be starting up in the next couple of weeks, if these areas are not too big, probably less than 2 feet in diameter, they're going to fill in and be beautiful without any special effort from you. If they are bigger, go to some spots in your yard where you're St. Augustine's nice and thick, and dig up some, little squares, maybe 3 inches square, plant in the middle of those dead areas, and once again, fertilizer and compost, and a little warm weather, a little bit of water, and it'll fill back in pretty quickly.
Okay. Just another little note. I was going through some of my cabinets, and I found I had, last year when the okra was growing, some of them got very long, so I guess I threw them into a pail. And now they're all dried out. Will those seeds that are in that okra be of any viability?
Pick up the seed pod and shake. If you hear the seeds rattling around inside, they're probably quite viable. If they are still adhered to the omentum, as it's called in the pod, probably not. But if you can pick up those seed pods and shake them, and I think you will hear things rattling around, that seed's going to be about the size of double aught buckshot. Soak in a little bit of Garrett juice. You should have probably 80-90% viability on it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they do rattle. So.
Oh yeah, then they're just fine. Don't worry about them.
Well, I'll tell you this though. When I broke open one the other day, there's so many seeds in there. It's unbelievable.
You don't have to save a lot of pods to have your next year's crop of okra out there. That's for sure. But no, it's a dry seed. So just a brief soak, 10 or 15 minutes. I would put a couple of ounces, a couple of jiggers of Garrett juice, in a, you know, good sized cup of water and just put them in there to soak for about 15 minutes and plant them. That'll really speed up the speed with which they germinate. It'll also increase the percentage of the seed that sprouts and grows. Plant them, if you've got plenty of seed, plant them relatively close together, 2-3 inches apart. And then once they come up and start, you can see which ones are the really strong plants. Leave those behind and go through and thin the others out to where your okra is about 6 inches apart. Because as you well know, it makes a big, vigorous plant.
Two plants is all I need. My wife gets tired of okra.
Oh, well, you don't like it as much as I do, and maybe you should pickle some of it. Get out your, you know, so easy to preserve book, and in my world, there's not a whole lot better when it comes to, you know, low calorie, high taste snack foods. Pickled okra is one of the better things on my list, and you can make it yourself, or you can find it at the grocery store, but. If you've got surplus okra, you know, try pickling some sometime. It's mighty good.
Very good. Even when it gets too long, like some, you know, when you all of a sudden it went from 4 inches to 8 inches, and you know, oh, that's too tough to eat.
No, throw that over the fence for the cows to eat is what I do. Because once it's tough, it's, you know, going to be tough as shoe leather. But that's why what my rule is, I go through the garden picking okra, Robert, is if you can snap it just with your two fingers, if it snaps off, it's going to be good and edible. If it's tough and you have to cut it off the plant, nah, that one's probably best, you know, given to somebody else.
Yes. Okay, Mr. Bob, that's all I got for this morning.
You get out and have a wonderful weekend then. I appreciate the call.
Bye, Bob.
Goodbye. Let's get a break in here, and then we'll get back to phone calls. I didn't look at Don's list yet, but I probably still having a line or two open, so dial 210-599-5555. Looks like I get to talk about Medina, and we were just talking about Medina's fine fertilizer products. The dry growing green, still, you know, there's nothing better in the market out there. Stewart uses top quality materials and fortifies it with all sorts of wonderful things, some of which are on the bag. Not everything that is in there is on the bag, because every time he puts something on the bag, he has to spend a lot of money getting that label approved. So just know the Growing Green contains everything your plants are going to need to do well. Want a little bit faster results? We'll go with one of their fine liquid products. Has to grow plant, has to grow lawn, liquid fish blend. Medina makes great liquid fertilizers as well. Soil too hard? Well, start using the Medina Plus or the original Medina Soil Activator. Start using those on a regular basis. It won't happen overnight, but take the word of thousands of farmers and ranchers around the world. It really does work over time, and those guys, that's what I was laughing about, is some of them don't buy as much of it anymore is because their hard soil's gotten so soft their equipment bogs down. That'd be a real pleasant problem to have in your yard, I know, but, you know, give the regular use of the Medina Plus or the Medina Soil Activator. That's what it's designed to do for you. Medina also packages some of the best orange oil in the business, along with molasses and liquid seaweed. If you want to see the whole list of products, just go to their website at medinaag.com. It's a great company, great products. Find them wherever fine gardening products are sold. Medina Agriculture.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Greg, Todd, and John are my next three callers, and Greg's first. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm off to a good start. It's going to be a beautiful day out there.
Great. Got a couple questions. First one's about some plants that aren't coming up. I've got a Mexican bird of paradise. It's about a year old, and it still hasn't come up. Is it too late, or you think it'll still come up?
I think you got a good chance it's still going to come up. You know, it's the weather has been wonderful, and we've had some warm afternoons, but the soil is still cold. If you got out your soil probe thermometer, you'd find that it's still kind of not maybe wintertime temperatures, but it's certainly not real warm yet. And Pride of Barbados, a Mexican bird of paradise, is very definitely a tropical plant, and it doesn't like it warm. It likes it hot. So the Mexican bird of paradise, firebush, there's several of those that just haven't sprouted up yet. I'm almost certain it'll come back for you.
So you think give it a few more weeks and literally plant it, or how long would you wait?
Well, there's not much decent stuff in the nurseries. Everything we're seeing is still pretty small. I'd wait till Mother's Day, you know, which is almost exactly a month away. If it hadn't sprouted by then, I think you'll find some nicer plants available then. And if yours, you know, was big enough to bloom and make seed, there's a good chance you may have some little seedlings sprout up around too from just seed that the plant produced last year. So no, I'd give it at least a month before you just think about buying any more.
Okay. What about same question with plumbago? I got about half of mine are coming up. The other half are just sitting there.
Funny you should mention that. My partner was working in her garden, and she had given up on her plumbago and started trying to dig it up. And lo and behold, when she got an inch down, she found that there were sprouts starting to come out all over the place. So, no, I give your plumbago a while longer, too.
Okay. And then I've got two mountain laurels that are about 3 years old. I'm trying to get them kind of shaped a little bit, and I really haven't trimmed them that much, hardly at all. But some of the limbs that are coming out from the base are they're like 3 or 4 feet long, but they sag. They seem to be so heavy, they're just sagging towards the ground. How do you fix that, or do you?
Well, that's somewhat normal. Again, if you want to take a little bit of the weight off of them so they be a little bit more upright, you can do that. If you want to brace them or tie them up, the wood will get much stronger given time. But, you know, if they're already kind of splayed out, they're going to get stronger in that position. If you can find a way, like to put a stake of some sort toward the center and just use a little bit of Velcro tape or something like that around to hold them more upright, then those limbs will strengthen and will be a little bit more upright. But given time, it's going to get more upright anyway. But a young mountain laurel tends to, especially this time of year, when we really haven't gotten into hot weather, all that new growth is coming out. Just the weight of it's going to pull it outward to some extent.
So staking it's okay. So that's what I'm seeing is not unusual, but it's either shorten it so it doesn't droop, or just stake it, but stake it now so that when it hardens off in the upright position.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay. Well, I'll give it a shot. Thank you very much.
You're certainly welcome. I appreciate the call this morning. Thank you. Next in line will be Todd. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning. Got what I call grass burrs. How can I get rid of them?
Well, we call them a real pain in the grass. I'll tell you what I did. They're an annual grass. They die every winter, but all those burrs that they left behind are going to come up and deal you even more misery this year. I don't know how well this will work coming out this late. I think it kind of depends on, how many of them have already sprouted. But I had a patch, some we used for a croquet court, that was probably 20 feet long and 30 feet long, 20 feet wide, 30 feet long, maybe. And the grass burrs were so thick the dogs wouldn't walk into the area. This was in, I want to say, probably November. I put down about a half an inch of compost over that area. And the next spring, I think I pulled 3 or maybe 4 grass burr plants out the whole summer long. So I've never found anything that worked as well as a pre-emergent to keep the grass burrs from coming up. And like I say, we're into April, and so some of these things may have already germinated and started to grow, and when that happens, pre-emergence of any sort don't work against them. But If compost is more work than you want to do, you might put out some corn gluten meal. That will at least keep the seeds will sprout anyway, but the way a pre-emergent works, it keeps the seedling from developing a root system, and then it just dehydrates and dies. So if it's not in the time or budget to top dress it with compost, I would at least get some corn gluten meal. Probably, I'm trying to remember the exact name they put it under, the company called Nature's Creation puts out a very good spreadable corn gluten meal, I think it's just what they call it, and that will work to some degree. But make certain next fall that you get some compost on this area, and you should be totally free of them next spring. I'd like to have a magic bullet for this summer, but unfortunately it's the ones that have sprouted, all you're going to be able to do is pull them or go around and individually spray them with the vinegar and orange oil to kill them. Once they get started growing, the pre-emergents don't work.
Okay, I appreciate it.
That's really by far the best way to go after them. If you're out in the country, some people actually get so desperate in the fall that they actually burn the yard because that will kill the seeds. But that's not practical in town, and right now with the rest of your good better grass coming out green, it's not something I would recommend. But again, put out some corn gluten meal or some compost to take care of anything that hasn't sprouted. But anywhere that you can tell the difference, anywhere that you can distinguish between a good grass and a grass burr, just pull it out and dispose of it.
Yeah, I'm out in the country, so
okay.
Burning it would not be a problem.
Yeah. But your better grass, even the Bermuda is starting to green up out in the country, so it's probably too late to do that this year, but some people do it in the fall. I think the compost, is the best idea because it not only eliminates the grass burrs, but it's just amazing what it does for your grass, whether it's Bermuda or whatever else. Just a great practice. Now, if you're looking at acres where you have a problem, you may want to go overseed with some good native grass. I used to grow and bale hay for my cattle till I just got to where I didn't have time to do it. And the area where I was growing Sudan, man, the grass burrs were so thick you couldn't walk into it. In that area, I just got some native grass blend from Douglas King Seed. Stopped tilling it, stopped plowing it and planting it, and within 3 years I couldn't find a grass burr anywhere. So if you've got acreage, be careful that you're not overgrazing it and maybe overseed with some of the native grasses, which will ultimately choke it out. But in your yard, you can take a little more definitive action.
Okay. Have a good day.
Well, you do the same, and do a rain dance. I hope you were under some of the good clouds last week, but a lot of the rest of us sure would like to see a little bit more of that stuff falling.
Oh, we got about 2.5 inches, so.
I'm jealous. You're living right. Well, get out and enjoy, and I know we'll talk again. And right now, I'll take a moment and talk to you about Kinetico, my favorite water softener in the industry, for a lot of what I think are very good reasons. Kinetico water softeners work on the kinetic energy in the water, not on electricity, so you're not affected by power surges or lightning strikes or power outages. You know, your power goes out. If you go into those electronic water heater or water softeners, you don't have any soft water anymore. You always have soft water with your Kinetico, though, because it doesn't plug in. And it's so much more efficient. In fact, the water softener industry voted it the most efficient water softener out there. That saves you salt, that saves you water, that saves you money. It does not recharge on a preset schedule. It only recharges when the rosin needs to be recharged. Yet you never run out of soft water because it's a twin tank system. But you can tell I love my Kinetico. Recommend it very, very highly to you. They're so sure you like it, they'll even let you try it for 90 days before you pay for it. Check them out online at KineticoSA.com or give them a call, 210-656-PURE for Kinetico.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Do have a couple of open lines. So if you're getting a busy signal there for a while, well, dial now, 210-599-5555. Next two callers are going to be John and Pam. John's up first. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Two questions, good morning, please.
All right, sir.
What's the time factor for putting down grass seed in bare areas and putting down fertilizer?
On organic fertilizer, there is no, you know, time limit. You can put it on hot or cold, wet or dry. As I always say, it doesn't do any good in the bag, so get it on as quickly as you can. But there's never a bad time to put out, you know, your landscape fertilizer. On the other hand, with grass seed, about the only seed that you will be planting during the warm months is Bermuda grass. You know, the tiff grasses and things like that and bluestem things like that don't grow in our part of the world through the winter months. So Bermuda is about the only seed you're going to be planting. Typically, the soil is warm enough around Mother's Day. You could probably do it now, but I think you'd be wise to wait just a little bit. You put it out, you water it 2-3 times a day until it sprouts and starts growing, and then you can plant more anytime you like through the summer months. But that's really about the only grass you're going to plant from seed.
Okay, a second question. I need to screen my side yard. Neighbors put in a pool, and I want to screen that out.
Uh-huh.
What do you recommend that would be evergreen, grow about 6-7 foot tall, be real bushy, and it's in a shady area?
Well, still the couple of the fastest growing, densest things you can plant. One of them is called xylosma, spelled X-Y-L-O-S-M-A. The other is loquat, or Japanese plum, L-O-Q-U-A-T. And there are some fairly fast-growing forms of viburnum. There's one called chindo. There's one called mirror leaf. And all three of these things are going to grow where you have a nice hedge within a year or two. Problem is that if we go back to having these winters, when it gets down in the 10-degree range, they can have some freeze damage. If you want something that is totally cold-hardy, I would go with one of the bigger hollies. There's one called Nellie Stevens. There's one called Foster's. There's another one called Standard Burford. These are all going to get up in the 8 to 10 foot range, but they're a whole lot slower growing. The others, like I say, you'll have a tall hedge in a year or two. The others, it may take several years for them to really get up and give you that dense screen. I'll give you one other option, and that is if you have a fence in that area, especially if you can, you know, extend it, make it just a little bit taller. There is a beautiful vine. It's in full bloom right now around town. It's called either star jasmine or Confederate jasmine, and it will grow all the way to the top of a 10-foot fence in about 2 or 3 months' time when it starts growing in the spring. So it too can get a little bit of cold damage. Now, we've got a lot of it. If you're ever driving down Sunset Road, look at the front of our parking lot area here at the nursery, and you'll see a gorgeous sea of white flowers out there right now. It's frozen back a couple of times, but it's come right back. But a good compromise would be if you have a fence or trellis or anything like that, you could plant the Confederate jasmine and let it know that it's going to give you a dense cover within a few months. And then maybe in front of that, you could plant a row of one of these slower growing, more cold hardy hollies. And that way you'll have instant screening, but if you have freeze damage later on in a year or two or three, you'll have a permanent, totally cold-hardy green shrub coming up. Does that make sense? Are you still with me, John?
Yes, I'm still here, yes.
Yeah, those are your options. It just, if you're like me, I would want basically instant screening. And like I say, you'll get that with some of those faster-growing shrubs. Or if you have a fence or something, you can plant the star jasmine on it. It'll be 10 feet tall and dense, you know, by midsummer. The stuff just grows unbelievably quickly. But, again, if we get a really cold winter, it's going to freeze back to some degree. Even after the winter of 21, ours here at the nursery froze down to ground level, but I don't think a single plant died. And within a few months, it was back up to the top of an air fence is about 6 feet out there, and it was back up over the top within a few months of next spring. So those are your options. You have to decide what works best in your situation and your landscape.
Hey, thank you. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the call this morning. I believe that John is up next. Let's go ahead and talk to John. Or it's Pam. Pam is up next. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a question. I have a question for you. I have a sister who lives in Galveston.
Uh-huh.
She has a large garden in her backyard, and she's recently had back surgery. She's not able to get out and pull weeds like she once was able to do.
Uh-huh.
She has a large or an oval center bed that's about 8 foot by 10 foot, and she wondered what kind of a ground cover could she put there. It's full sun, and it's not just sand. It's improved soil.
Okay. I would say the hardiest thing would be Asian jasmine.
Okay.
That's the only problem is it's one of those ground covers that we always say the first year it sleeps, the second year it creeps, the third year it leaps. So she has a choice there. She can plant a little bit larger plants, have a little bit faster coverage, and spend substantially more money. Or she can plant the little 4-inch pots, which is what most people do, and just be patient with it. Now, there is another ground cover that has not any serious problems, but it's called Vinca Major. There's Vinca Major, Vinca Minor. Vinca Minor does better in the shade. Vinca Major does fine in the full sun. It grows extremely quickly, has little lavender flowers, a little bit taller growing. It's probably going to get 10 to 12 inches where the jasmine's going to stay 4 or 5 inches. My grandfather had Vinca Major in a portion of his backyard, and every now and then it would get a little infestation of a little green caterpillar, and you'd look at it on Friday, and it was a dense green ground cover. You'd look at it on Monday, and it was nothing but stems with leaves trying to come back out again. So Vinca Major, that'll give her a dense ground cover practically overnight. But it does get some little caterpillar problems periodically. So you may end up spraying periodically with BT. But long-term, toughest, hardiest Asian jasmine, you want something pretty immediately, look at Vinca Major, and both of them will do well in her area.
Is Vinca Major available at most nurseries now?
It's available at a lot of them.
Okay. I'm not really aware of that plant. It's not on my radar.
Well, and the Vinca Minor would probably do okay. I know it's available. I bought about 10 flats of it this past week, as a matter of fact. But it's just not quite as sun tolerant. But there's even a variegated form of it. And this isn't a giant bed. She might even look at planting. There's one called Wojo's Wonder. There's another one that's just a beautiful variegated kind of cream and green leaf. And like I say, they all produce an attractive lavender purple flower. So that might be one of the fastest things to look at for, you know, just some pretty almost instantly.
Does the Asian jasmine, is that the one that you have to prune back every once in a while?
Maybe every 5 to 10 years.
Oh, well, that's not bad. Okay. She can handle that.
I think so.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. You get out and have a good weekend. Let's see here. I tell you what, let's go ahead and take a quick break here. I do have a couple of open lines, so give me a call, 210-599-5555. Let's talk for a minute about a great company called Aqualock, new company up in the Burney area, veteran-owned, great guy, as a matter of fact, recently promoted military. Neat guy, but came up with a product that is, I guess, totally chemically correct. We call it a hydrophilic colloid. It is a product which absorbs and holds moisture without depleting the soil of oxygen. I guess if you overdid it, you could keep it too wet. But it's just a neat product designed for you to mix into the soil, maybe in your pots, your hanging baskets. It has to be mixed in, so you can use it in the vegetable garden and flower gardens and things, but you do have to kind of blend it into the soil. You can't just put it on the surface. You'll end up with a layer of jelly on top. But this is a product they call TerraLock, and it can really, really reduce the frequency that you have to water things in the summer months. So I especially like to suggest that it be mixed in with so your potting soil, so that you don't have to spend as much time and as much money on water. Their other great product is called Supercast, and it's a really, really top quality worm casting product, which has some of the TerraLock mixed in so that it does need water less often, but it works to fortify your soil, has lots of biostimulants in it, and it really helps things grow better. A couple of great products, TerraLock and Supercast. Both of them from a company called Aqualock. You will find these products at your favorite nursery or garden center. Look for them. You won't water as often this summer.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to the phone lines as well as, it's just going to be such a pretty day out there. Hope you're going to spend some of it outside. Hope you're going to spend some of it in the garden. Mike and Omar are my next two callers, and Mike's up first. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Bob Webster. How are you doing?
Good morning. It's off to a good start. I'm glad, as we always say, nice thing about radio, you only have to sound awake. You don't have to look awake, but I think I'm faking it pretty well today.
Uh-huh. Hey, thank you for making this area, San Antonio, more beautiful one house at a time.
Well, appreciate that.
Hey, I've got amaryllis, and they are blooming right now, you know, of course, I'm sure. There's about 8 of them, so I want to have more.
Uh-huh.
Can I do something with the ones that are active right now, like split up the bulbs and propagate them somehow, or what do you do with the amaryllis?
Are these the ones that have really big bulbs?
I haven't touched the bulbs. I'm scared to touch them. They're so beautiful. I've never gone down and looked.
Okay, that tells me what I need to know. And what colors? Are they just a mixture of colors? Are they all red? What do you have?
Mostly red, but they've got all kinds of different colors mixed in with them, yellows and stuff.
Okay, well, the reason I ask, there are really two kinds of amaryllis. The ones that we see around the holidays, ones that usually have great big bulbs, are more properly called hippiastrum, whereas the true amaryllis is a smaller bulb, what they sometimes call American amaryllis. The American amaryllis are totally cold hardy. You plant them in the flower bed and they come up year after year after year. Every 3 or 4 years you can dig and divide those bulbs, and they are by far the hardiest. The hippiastrums, the Dutch amaryllis, are a little more cold sensitive, and if you plant them in the ground, you have to be careful to really mulch them heavily in the winter months, or they can freeze and die. If you have them in pots, you will end up dragging those pots in 2 or 3 nights a year when we're going to get significantly below freezing. As far as dividing, yes, your big bulbs will make smaller bulbs out to the side. You want to leave them attached until the new bulbs are the size of a golf ball at least. And the best time to do it, unfortunately, is not right now. The time we always, pretty much all bulbs, we dig and divide opposite the bloom season. Your amaryllis are spring flowering bulbs and your hippiastrums. So if they bloom in the spring, we're going to dig and divide in the fall. So not something you want to put on today's agenda, because if you dig them while they're still, they're just starting to put up their big leaves to make all their growth for the summer months. So I wouldn't try dividing them now. Fall, you can dig them up. Probably everywhere you had one big bulb, you'll have 3 or 4 smaller bulbs that you can break off and get started. Of course, you know, the surest way to do it is just buy more bulbs, but they can be expensive, especially if they're fairly large bulbs. But just be aware that there is an American amaryllis, usually the variety is called Johnson Eye, that you just plant in the flower beds and forget about, enjoy the blooms every spring. The bigger, brighter colors are really Dutch amaryllis, and they take a little bit more effort to keep them pretty and healthy.
The way I have ignored them, and they love it, I'm pretty sure I have the American variety.
Oh, okay. So. Well, in that case, figure, you know, right now you're going to let them come out. You're going to let them put on all the green growth they can because this is the time the bulbs are, you know, getting ready for next year. And let me get Don to put you back on hold so we can talk a little bit more in a minute. This is KTSA Radio San Antonio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
And we do have a couple of open lines, so grab one of them at 210. You just heard the number, 210-599-5555. I'm going to visit just a little more with Mike, and then it'll be PJ and Lucy. And, Mike, just a couple more things I wanted to tell you about with the amaryllis, or really with most any other bulbs, whether they're narcissus or iris or anything else, is that right now is the time of the year when those green leaves that are really just probably just starting to come out profusely, that's what the plant uses to put the energy back in the bulb, which is what's going to make more little smaller bulbs off to the side, which is what's going to make for a heavy blooming next fall. So for now, water them, fertilize them, treat them like you would the best house plants you've got. And the late summer, you'll start withholding the water, let them go into their dormant state. And that is the time that if you want to dig them and divide them, you certainly can. Anything that's, you know, say the size of a marble up to the size of a ping pong ball, I would leave it attached to the mother bulb, so to speak. Anything that's, you know, a third or larger the size of the biggest bulbs, you can go ahead and separate those out. Let them dry for 3 or 4 days. When you break them off from the mother bulb, it'll take a few days for that to dry out. You don't want to be putting it in a moist soil until it has dried out off to callus over. And then just replant and get ready with more beautiful flowers in a different area next year.
Fantastic. Okay, so let them get the size of about a golf ball.
That's what I would recommend.
Dry them out, let them callus, and replant in a hardy soil.
That's it.
Excellent. Hey, do you do hummingbird nests in your property?
I occasionally find them. Hummingbirds are pretty good at camouflaging their nests, and they are the most intricate little work of art. They build that little nest. They cover it with lichens and things. And if you happen to find where they're nesting, you are very, very privileged. You know, I have seen them infrequently, and I just love hummingbirds. That's just a sound that's always welcome in our garden.
Well, I was thinking of using your wild birds and see if they had the pre-made little hummingbird houses and hang them up in some heavy trees that I've got around and see what happens.
I don't think you will ever find a hummingbird nesting in a house. You know, there are birds that do nest in houses.
In a tree.
Oh, like in a tree?
I've got some crepe myrtles that are way out by themselves.
Uh-huh.
And as they feed, they love sitting up in there watching and protecting their feeder.
Right.
So I'm thinking maybe it's a nest site, too. I don't know.
I'm not going to hurt anything to try. Just be sure it's in a good shady area because the nests that I have found have always been back in the fairly thick foliage of the trees. And I've seen them in, let's see, oak trees and mesquite trees, I think, are the two places that I've had the pleasure of actually seeing the nest. But give it a try. Nothing to lose. Just be sure it's well anchored wherever you put them up.
Will do. All right. Have a blessed day, Bob.
You do the same, Mike. Appreciate the call. Thank you, sir. PJ is up next. Good morning, PJ.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I hope I get to talk to you without getting a cough attack. And
I'll hope so as well. How can I help?
It's TJ with a T.
Okay. Oh, okay. Very good.
I got a 1 gallon wisteria, and I was planning on putting it on the northeastern side of my house, right outside of my bedroom window.
Okay.
Just I don't want to mess it up. I love that flower. I love the smell. Can you give me any advice?
Sure, be happy to. And it is a true wisteria. It's not what they call the evergreen wisteria?
As far as I know. Let me go look
at it. Okay. Yeah, it the true wisteria drops every one of its leaves in the winter months. The evergreen wisteria isn't really a wisteria. It has a beautiful, it does have a fragrant flower, but it retains its foliage, as the name would imply, pretty much year-round. It's again, the true wisteria will drop every leaf in the winter months.
Okay. Just bury it level with the ground. Don't overdo it.
Right. Don't plant it too deeply. Give it something to grow on. It has to have a trellis. Once it gets up to, you know, it can find a way. It doesn't make anything that will attach to your home or anything else. It will, you know, it may reach over and if it finds something that little stem can wrap around. It will grow way up tall, and which is, you know, what you want. You want as many of those fragrant flowers as you can possibly get. But if it is what they call the evergreen wisteria, which is probably called Meletia, that takes a real rich soil. It does much better in Houston than it does in San Antonio. So if it's a real dark green, I guess true wisteria, the leaves are a little bit lighter green. If yours has a really dark green, it may be, you know, what we call evergreen wisteria. If that's the case, work a bunch of compost in, really get your soil in a little bit better shape, because evergreen wisteria doesn't really like most of San Antonio. Now, if you're in Terrell Hills or down in King William, you've got good deep soil and the evergreen will do okay. But if you're further north and in poorer soil, to keep it pretty, to keep it, you know, green and blooming well for you, you need to improve the soil. You probably need to add some azomite and need to watch your watering really carefully. And next time you buy from somebody that can tell you the difference. The true wisteria has more fragrance and blooms much earlier in the spring, but it has a problem in that many varieties of the true wisteria like colder winters than we typically have. And some years when we have a warm winter, it just doesn't bloom well. When we have a cold winter, like we pretty much did this year, then you'll probably have beautiful flowers in the spring. But it's hard to give you real general information because I'm not sure what type of wisteria you're growing. But plant it, you know, with the soil at the same height, give it something to grow on. Water and fertilize regularly, and either way, you're going to have pretty flowers and real good, real good fragrance as well.
It says it's an amethyst false wisteria. It doesn't give me the
botanical.
No, yeah. It doesn't give me the botanical name. Well, and I did what you said not to do. I bought it at HEB because I just passed by it and I smelled it and I'm like, ooh.
Well, are the flowers light purple or dark purple?
They're lighter purple and they're small. They are, they're in between. They have, lavender. Yeah.
Well, that may very well be a true wisteria. And we'll just hope that it's one of the milder climate ones so that it does give you good flowers every spring. It's funny you mentioned HEB down at Central Market. They have some of the prettiest wisteria in San Antonio growing up that kind of trellis area. It's kind of over toward Patterson Street, but you probably have true wisteria, but just, you know, plant it where it gets at least a fair amount of sunlight and don't worry about protecting it in the winter. The more cold it gets, the more flowers it will have.
Okay. And my other question, and I'll leave you alone. I also bought sacks of strawberry roots. Is it okay to plant them now?
Well, you have to plant them. I mean, strawberries have to be growing in soil. They're just a little kind of a dry plant with roots, and the leaves on it may have gone into dormancy. But you cannot store bare root strawberries. You need to get them planted immediately. Either plant them in your garden or go ahead and pot them up into little 4-inch pots. But they need to be out where they get plenty of sun. They need to get very regular watering, and the best time to plant strawberries is in October or November, but nothing wrong with planting them now. You just you won't get nearly as many berries this year, but you'll at least get a good strawberry patch started.
Okay, so they're perennials.
Yes, they should be if you take good care of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All righty. Thank you very much.
You're certainly welcome, TJ. I appreciate the call this morning. Thank you. And once again, Celso, if you didn't hear me earlier, Mr. Celso Garcia is a man I got to know a few years ago when he won one of the top prizes down at the Poteet Strawberry Festival. Don't know how well he did this year, but, man, the chocolate-covered strawberries you brought by the nursery were absolutely wonderful, Celso, if you're listening, and really do appreciate you. Let's get a break, let's get a break out of the way here, and we'll be right back to phone calls. Looks like I get to talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center, and Fanix, you know, once again, celebrating 85 years in business this year, and they're doing all sorts of extra things, having some extra sales, having some extra seminars. This morning, 10 to 11:30, David Rodriguez is going to be over there talking about lawn management essentials and lots of information there that David will be giving you. Just reminded me to tell you all about the organics. And Fanix, kind of in celebration of things, is giving 20% off this weekend on all Fertilome products, all high-yield products, all natural guard products. So those are the two special things Fanix is doing. If you want to see all the special things they're doing, just go to the website at Fanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com. Just getting ready for kind of a big blowout in June when they're officially going to celebrate 85 years. Right now they're well-stocked on warm-weather veggies, warm-weather flowers. They want to remind you that the CPS Energy rebate program on planting shade trees, it ends the end of this month. So if you'd like to get some trees planted and have CPS Energy give you $50 credit per tree, well, talk to good folks over at Fanix who have the qualifying trees. Like I say, if you get a 5-gallon tree, the rebate you get from CPS will practically pay for that tree. They also have just gotten in a big shipment of colorful yard art. There are just lots and lots of reasons to get over and see them. They're over on Home Green Road, right where they've been for 85 years. And like I say, find more information at their website, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. It's going to be Lucy and then Bernie. Good morning, Lucy.
Hi.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
We're loudly and clearly.
Okay, great. Bob, we adopted some golden oldie donkeys about 3 years ago.
Okay.
And we get up there. It's over there by the natural area outside of Bandera.
Uh-huh.
And we go up there about every three days, and we rake all the poop up, and it all mixes with the straw and all that we feed them. Is that good to use for compost once it breaks down?
It depends on, you know, that on the material. If the straw, when it was growing, if it was sprayed with, there's a weed killer out there called Picloram. It's holding their names like Grazon and P plus D. And unfortunately, it doesn't break down. Once it's on anything that they, eat, it just passes right through the donkeys, comes out in the manure, and, kills everything except grass. It'll kill oak trees. It'll kill anything out there. So if you can be certain that your straw is clean and was not sprayed before it was baled and sold, then it's a fine thing to use. But, and one of the things that you can do if you want to test it is take a little sample of the straw and manure, put it in a 5-gallon bucket, fill it with water, soak it overnight, and then go out and find a broadleaf weed like henbit or a dandelion or clover or something like that. Pour the water over that and watch it for 48 hours. If the weed starts to shrivel and die, then you'll know that it's contaminated and you should not use it in your garden or it'll kill everything there. If the weeds continue to grow, then at least this batch was clean and it is just fine to use around the garden.
Okay, now would that apply to hay also?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's this, a lot of us feel like this material should be banned, but it practically put some compost companies out of business. Even Malcolm Beck had a real problem getting Picloram contamination, and everywhere he sold his compost for a brief period there before he figured out what was going on, it just killed people's gardens, killed people's flower beds, and I guess for the hay growers, they like it because it's designed to kill everything except grass. And people that are, you know, trying to have weed-free hay, that's what they do. But it's a very high price to pay because a lot of farmers, a lot of ranchers have found out that, you know, the cattle eat this hay. Then they go out and lie down underneath the biggest tree in the pasture, sleep it off, and when they get up, they leave some manure behind, and first thing you know, that big pecan, that big oak tree, whatever, is dying from this picloram that passed all right through the animal, came out in the manure, and then suddenly got put in a place you didn't want it.
Okay, well, let me ask you this also. If I find out that it's okay after doing this experiment, do I need to heat that compost up? I've read somewhere where it needs to be heated up to about 150 degrees or something.
No, it's self-heating, so to speak. As the microbes start breaking down, decomposing the material, the temperature goes way up. That's why if you look at a compost pile in the middle of the winter, you'll see steam coming off of it. But it's not something that you apply the heat. The heat is a natural heat of decomposition, and you'll know your compost is finished and ready when it stops being hot. You know, when you can stick your hand into the pile and it's warm, it's still breaking down. Once it is fully broken down, it's ready to be used anywhere you want to. But you don't apply the heat. In fact, you can get it hotter faster. You know, if you water it down with some molasses, or if you work some dry molasses into it, the things that the microbes basically use to eat, so to speak, you can heat it up faster, but it's not like you light a fire under it or anything else. It happens totally naturally.
Okay. Well, we're not out there to turn it all the time. It's mostly just waking it up. So.
Well, even the people that make compost in huge quantities, they've pretty much stopped turning it all the time, because turning it may give you good bacterial compost, but it pretty much destroys the fungal component of the compost, which is also very valuable. Virtually every big compost company now uses what we call static pile composting, and they only turn it every 6 months. So the old way of turning it frequently, no, it doesn't give you nearly as good quality compost. So don't worry about the fact that you're not up there to turn it. You're going to get better compost as a result.
Well, I've noticed a number of the piles, when I do go up there and kind of rake underneath it's already turned to dirt, or it looks like dirt.
And that's perfect material. That's fully broken down compost. And had you gone up and stuck your hand in the pile the 2 or 3 months before it got to that point, you would have felt plenty of heat. It can go up. In fact, your bigger compost companies have to be careful that they don't make their piles too large and too deep, because they'll sometimes have spontaneous combustion. And I've had 2 or 3 people tell me you're not really a good composter if you haven't had a spontaneous fire out in your compost piles every now and then. So they do generate a lot of heat. Now, that's not likely to happen with any little compost pile that you're creating. But if you were like the big guys and had a compost pile that was 15 feet high and 20 feet wide, then you have to be real careful that it doesn't overheat itself.
Okay, great. Well, that's good information. Thank you so much.
I do my best to provide it, and you enjoy your donkeys and your day out in the country.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Lizzie. Goodbye. All right, let's go ahead and talk to Bernie. Good morning, Bernie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I've got a problem. My daughter moved into a house that she had redone, and the front yard, I guess the side yards too, are just covered with stuff. You know, and yesterday I actually vacuumed the yard.
Uh-huh. Wow.
I mean, I never thought in my life I would vacuum a yard, but I was. People were laughing at me, but that's okay.
So, is this what you're calling dust? Is this something that, you know, when you walk through it, it actually looks like dust in the air? It's probably not dust. It's probably, you know, fungal spores. It's probably coming from things that are breaking down in the grass, and it looks like dust, but it's actually, and unfortunately for a lot of people, it's quite an allergen, but that probably isn't dust. Those are probably just natural, harmless fungal spores that are the result of just things breaking down in the soil, perhaps some of the grass that died over the winter months, the fungi. Fungus actually breaks down a lot more woody material than bacteria do, and in the process, it makes these little fungal spores. So all I can really tell you is just spray it down with water a little bit more often, and it shouldn't be an issue.
Well, it was a lot of stuff in the ground. I mean, it was white. Some of it I could tell was styrofoam, but some of it I couldn't tell what it was. But, you know, and the ground is really hard. So, you know, it looks like it was Bermuda grass before, but it looks stagnant right now.
Well, it's still for Bermuda grass. I mean, Bermuda grass would love it if it was 105 degrees every day. Bermuda loves heat, and we just haven't had that much heat, which we certainly appreciate, but your Bermuda's just not really kicked into its spring growing season at this point. If you haven't fertilized in the past 2 or 3 months, I would put out some fertilizer, and that Bermuda will come out. Fertilizer and water, you should get a nice, strong growth, but just let it get a little bit hotter. Wait till after Mother's Day or so, and you'll all of a sudden see lots of growth in your Bermuda grass. I'm pretty certain that it's not dead. It just wants to see the nights especially warm up a bit before it starts growing.
Okay. Well, should I put compost on it or something? Because the ground is really hard.
Compost would help a great deal. Compost would help a great deal. It's moderately expensive, and it is a good deal of work to put it out. But I don't know of any one single thing that will improve your soil and improve your grass more than compost will.
Oh, okay. All right, that and fertilizer. So should I put the compost down first or the fertilizer down first?
It's up to you. I think it's better to put the fertilizer down first, but there's no mandate about that. You do whatever is convenient for Bernie.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. I appreciate the call this morning, Bernie. Thank you. Goodbye. All right. I get to talk about somebody else that I really appreciate, and that's my friend Rhonda out at Rhonda's Nature's Way. Had the great pleasure of getting a gift certificate from Rhonda to give to a friend. We were talking about reflexology, which is one of the things that Rhonda does there at the store. And the friend was saying, oh, it's been years. She just moved from a different part of the world and said, been years since I had a great reflexology session, and was very happy to get a gift certificate so she could get one from Rhonda's. Of course, the main thing I go to Rhonda's for is supplements, is natural things. I mean, keeping your immune system strong is extremely important to me. I've recently started taking a product Rhonda recommended that works against leg cramps. And let me tell you what, it's boron multivitamin material, absolutely wonderful. And we're getting into hot weather. When you work and sweat in the heat, you really need to replace those electrolytes. We don't take the salt tablets we did back when I was in college. And please, unless you want to be really fat, don't be drinking all those sports drinks that are loaded up with sugar. Go to Rhonda and get some of the Ultima. It's a neat product. Comes in little individual old straw-like packages. You add that to about 8 ounces of water and shake it up. Tastes absolutely wonderful. Gives you the electrolytes you need, but virtually, well, I don't think there's any sugar in it and no carbs in it. It just tastes wonderful without all the things that you don't want. Comes in a lot of different flavors, too. I still have to admit raspberry is my favorite, but the lemonade, the strawberry, all of them are absolutely delicious. And let me tell you, you don't want heat stroke. You want to be sure you're getting the electrolytes you need when you're working out in the heat. And Ultima, that I get at Rhonda's Nature's Way, well, that's for the best one that I know of. Rhonda also has some things that will really help you if you're trying to take some pounds off, some things that add a lot of flavor and a lot of nutrition without calorie and carbs. Been looking at her, been trying a product that she has called Total Protein. Comes in both a bar and a cookie. Hey, that stuff is delicious, and I think just zero sugar in it. Just get over and see Rhonda. She's open Monday through Sunday. She and her staff, I'm sorry, Monday through Saturday, closed on Sundays. But Monday through Saturday, see Rhonda and her staff. They can answer your questions. They can help you with the products that you need to get healthy and stay healthy. It's Ronta's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Pat and Mark are my next two callers, and Pat's first. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Bob. Thank you for taking my call and for all the knowledge you share with everybody.
It's my great pleasure.
It's great. See, I have asparagus, and I've been eating asparagus. All of a sudden, I'm getting, it's less than maybe like pencil thin things are just coming up all over. So do I cut that down so that the thicker ones come up, or do I just leave it go to a,
no, it's probably time to stop harvesting and let it make its little ferny growth for the summer months. In fact, what I usually end up doing is, and mine is kind of up against the fence, and I'll kind of wrap a rope around it so that it, those little ones coming up, so they don't get broken over in these kind of fierce winds we've had a bit. But no, at this point, I think it's time to let them grow up, start putting the energy back into the plant so you can pick even longer next spring.
Oh, so I can't. I tried it. I have beautiful greens. That's right. But I like to just stand here and eat it off the fence. So
And you can do that a little bit. But when you stop getting the big shoots coming up, that's telling you that it's you need to let it go do its thing. If you want to eat it for another week or two, go ahead. But as we get into the summer months, it needs to make that foliage, because that's what allows the plant to store the energy so that it can come back next spring and do it all over again.
Because it's mixed with the big ones and the little ones, but I have never seen so many little ones as this year.
Well, you're taking good care of it.
Oh, hey, I love my asparagus. What do you feed it with? I've just been doing the Astrogrow plant and liquid seaweed and whatever. Is there anything specific?
Well, most everything that I grow, I like to give it a good granular fertilizer the early season, and then follow it up with the liquid, either has to grow plant or with the liquid fish blend. In fact, I alternate those two back and forth,
right. And
it works well on just everything, whether it's tomatoes or asparagus or beans or just about anything else you're growing. So the dry fertilizer is just kind of in case I get so busy that I don't have time to do the liquid. And believe me, being in the nursery business, that does happen periodically. But the dry fertilizers there to carry things through and be sure they're getting the basic nutrient they need. But when you can use the liquid, it just kind of kickstarts it and you get more production more quickly.
Well, geez, thank you. I did remember something that you told me to do, but that's what I've been doing.
I'll bet you remember a lot if you're doing that well with your asparagus, Pat.
Okay, well, thanks a lot and blessings to all of you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. You too. Bye. Mark is up next. Good morning, Mark.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a couple of questions. So first one, my mom is wanting a magnolia tree for Mother's Day.
Okay.
And I'm trying to figure out, she didn't have the best soil, you know, San Antonio. It's got that real hard clay soil. So I'm trying to figure out how to go about what variety and how to plant it.
Okay. What part of town does your mom live in?
Northeast side.
Okay. Like inside 1604, somewhere around 35, whereabouts?
Right within 410.
Okay. Well, actually, most of that area, the soil may be hard, but at least you have soil. You don't have the rock that if you get in northwest San Antonio. So she should do okay with a magnolia tree. There are basically two, well, there's more types, but if she wants what we recognize as a magnolia, there are two kinds. One of them is called a little gem, G-E-M. And it's not really a dwarf, but it's a slow growing variety. The leaves are a little smaller, flowers are a little smaller, but it's one of the best ones for this area, and it just blooms up a storm in the spring. If you've ever taken her over to Papado's for lunch or something, the magnolias that you see growing around those restaurants, those are the little gem variety. They ultimately they get large, but they grow pretty slowly. But they do extremely well in San Antonio. You can also grow the big Magnolia grandiflora, which is what the ones you see in Louisiana and Alabama and places like that. They have the bigger leaves. the bigger flowers, but they don't have as many flowers. And they're a little bit pickier in their growth. But with both of them, the real secret is wherever you plant them, don't plan on planting anything underneath them. Let your magnolia make those big leaves, those big limbs that come practically down to the ground, because what the tree is doing is shading the soil and keeping it cooler. You will help the tree at any point in its life. You put out 2 or 3 inches of mulch over the root zone of the tree, and the magnolia will be that much happier and will grow that much better. But be sure it never gets bone dry. When you water it, water it really thoroughly. Let it get dry about an inch deep between waterings, and not going to grow super quickly. But if your mom loves magnolias and that's what she wants for Mother's Day, then, you know, think about maybe even take her by Papados or something like that and look at the little gem and see if she's happy with that, because that's the one that's going to grow most easily here. If she wants the old-fashioned big magnolias, well, that's fine as well. You just have to be real careful not to over-trim it, to let it have its low foliage, and, you know, just keep a good mulch on the surface all the time. And Northeast San Antonio, she'll do just fine.
Now, as far as, like, putting it in the ground and what kind of soil, what do you recommend for that?
Well, in general, just use the same soil you take out of the hole. You don't want to dig a hole and then put the best soil in the world around the tree, or the tree has no reason to grow its roots out into the surrounding soil. It just wants to kind of pretend it's in a flower pot with good soil, and the roots just go round and round where they are. So I believe in just, you know, when you're planting, be sure you don't plant it any deeper. Be sure you plant it so that you can actually see those roots at the base starting to flare out. But just use the soil you took out of the hole back in around it. But then on top of the soil, put some good compost, put some good mulch, not just right at the base of the tree, but, you know, on out 2 or 3 feet around it. And that's what you want to do. Now, if you want to put down a little good fertilizer, and you don't have to be putting out any special extra expensive chemical food that says magnolia food on it, just your good Medina or Maestro Grow or Nature's Creation, any of their good organic fertilizers will work well. I would probably add a little bit of this product called Azomite, which is a great micronutrient blend. And because magnolias do like a little bit richer, better soil, you can either put your Azomite on the surface, or you can kind of mix it with the native soil as you put it back in the hole. It'll never burn, doesn't, you know, cause any problems whatsoever. But I think your magnolia will be much happier if you put some Azomite back in, either into the soil or put it on the surface when you're putting your mulch and things around.
Okay. All right. Awesome. Very good. And one last question is kind of weird. So we buy the molasses all the time, you know, for gardening purposes. And my wife drinks a lot of tea.
Uh-huh.
And she was wondering, are you able to put molasses, or is it edible?
Well, there are an awful lot of people, me included, that grew up putting molasses on their pancakes and waffles and things like that. I would recommend that you not drink the material. If you're getting your molasses at a feed store or something like that, it's probably had some other things put in it that wouldn't necessarily be good for her. So get your molasses at the grocery store. And by the way, the grocery store molasses can be used in the garden, but just not the other way around. Your garden molasses is probably not what you want to put in your tea, but you can put your grocery store molasses in the garden, if that makes sense. But it's just, molasses is high in sugars. Sugars are what keep your microbes reproducing and active, and adding molasses really keeps up that microbial activity. That does a lot of good things to soften the soil and help the things that colonize the plant roots. So I guess that would be the best way to put it. You can put grocery store molasses into the garden, but don't put garden variety molasses, you know, into your tea or on your pancakes.
Okay, I'll let her know, because every time we mix it, it smells really good. And I was like, well, she's like, well, can I put that in my tea? I said, I don't know. Let me ask him. I'm not too sure about that.
She may either start mooing or whinnying if she puts it into her tea. So, no, get the old Aunt Jemima or whichever one you find at the grocery store. It's just, again, agricultural molasses, they put some things in, probably wouldn't hurt you, but it's just not something that I'd be consuming. It's okay. it's a lower grade, so to speak, because, you know, what you're putting in your garden, the only thing that really matters is it's got lots of sugar in it, because that's what supports the microbes, and it doesn't have to be as clean and as flavorful and as free from all the other things that get boiled out when they make molasses out of sugar cane. So, no, just okay. enjoy the fragrance, but put the store-bought stuff on your pancakes and in the tea.
All right, then. I'll let her know that, and I appreciate the help. I appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure, Mark. Thank you for the call this morning.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Bye. All right, let's get our last break of the hour in here. And I get to talk to you about Green Grow Organics, Sam Sitterly's company. Just a neat, neat company run by a neat guy. I mean, Sam's been doing this for many, many years, has a wealth of knowledge about how to grow things well and how to correct problems when they occur. And for many, many years, that's been his business, mainly as a consultant. He still does that. If you want somebody that'll come walk your landscape with you, tell you what's right and what's wrong and how to correct it, well, they will certainly be the guy that does that. But his new program that he has, which I just love, is a program where, kind of like the guys that do use the bad stuff, they automatically come out on a quarterly basis. The difference is he doesn't use any of the bad stuff. Everything he does is totally organic, but you can get set up with him where, and there are no long-term contracts to sign or anything like that. He and his crews will come around on a quarterly basis, take care of the fertilizing, the compost tea application, beneficial nematodes if needed. It's just a great new service that Green Grow Organics provides. Check out their website, greengroworganics.com. If you have questions, give him a call. He's a great guy to talk to. He's Sam Sitterly, and phone number is 210-599-5565. Good company, Green Grow Organics.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Next two callers, Richard and Debbie. Richard called in first. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Just a beautiful morning out there. Can't wait to get back out into it.
Good. Got a couple of questions. I've got a little place over in Fort McCabot.
Okay.
And I've got some hair sheep, and I want to get some hay for them, but I cannot find organic hay. You know, hay has been organically fertilized.
Right. And you probably, gosh, you probably won't be able to. Organic hay is hard to find. The important thing, really, is not as much, you know, what was put into it. It's just what wasn't. You want to, if you possibly can, find hay that has not been sprayed with weed killer. You know, again, there's not really a big difference in the hay itself, whether it's organically grown or not. There's a big difference in what it does for the soil. And non-organic hay, you know, hay growers tend to burn their soil out. They put in more and more fertilizer, get less and less results. So it's not as good a quality hay, and it's not quite as nutritious, but it's not the end of the world if it's not organic. The important thing is just be sure that it hasn't been sprayed with Picloram or P+D or Grazon or any of those other chemicals that go through the sheep and, you know, then get left in the soil behind, which really starts messing things up there. So I tell you, if anybody knows, and it's not real near you, but in fact, it's not anywhere close to you at all, but call Fred Morales down at Morales Feed.
I live in Floresville, so, and I know Fred.
Okay. Ask Fred if he has any line on anybody that's growing organic hay. You might also ask it, you know, any of the other feed stores that you happen to visit. I know there's some out there, and again, as much hay as I go through with my cattle, I'm not able to find organic hay at a reasonable price, so I just buy from people that I know do not spray their hay with the Picloram. And I think that would be the same way on, you know, on your hair sheep, that I wouldn't worry that it's not organic, because as the name implies, you're not growing them for meat. So it's not as important that they be on an organic diet. But just try to stay away from hay that's been sprayed.
Well, actually, the hair sheep are for meat.
Oh, really? Well, you're teaching me something.
They have no wool.
Okay. Well, I'm a cattleman, not a sheep guy. So I just learned something for you, from you. So,
But what I was concerned with was earlier when you were talking about literally ruining your land.
Uh-huh.
You know, so the weed killer is what I really need to avoid, right?
Right. That's exactly right.
Okay. All right. Well, next is I'm building a small house out there, and I'd like a lawn. No, I don't want the lush that I have to water, you know, all the time.
Uh-huh.
Because I have no running water. It's all rain catchment. So,
good for you.
But I would like some kind of a small green. Most of it's going to be xeriscape, though.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Call Dean Williams over at Douglas King Seed, Southeast San Antonio, and talk to him about what they call Habiturf. Habiturf is a blend of three native grasses that it's what they've used up at the Wildflower Research Center up in the Austin area. But Habiturf is native grass that will do well for you, that doesn't require as much water, and yet it has a long green season. It is planted from seed, so it's not really expensive. But ask for Dean over there and tell him what you're interested in, and he may even have a couple of other suggestions to give you.
All right. Last but not least, save the best for the last. I'm by myself. I have help usually opening day of deer season.
Uh-huh.
But I need to. This place has not been grazed in like 10 or 15 years. The last 3 years I put sheep on it. But I've got a lot of cactus. I want to spray it. I think you said the diesel will break down eventually.
Well, but the best thing to do for cactus is don't spray it, but use your loader and just scrape it at ground level. Cactus does not come back from the roots. If you break it free, but push it into a pile, soak it down with molasses, and it will rot away before it has any chance to sprout and come back. It's virtually impossible to kill cactus by spraying it, but if you can simply shave it off at ground level, you will kill it. If you just leave it lie, it'll reroot and come back on you. But if you push it into a pile, make your molasses fairly strong, put maybe a cup to a gallon of water, and simply spray it down with that, and it will rot. It'll just turn into mush very quickly. It gets so lightweight, it'll practically blow away, but you'll be free of your cactus. You'll actually put some nutrient back into the soil, and you can avoid any chemicals whatsoever. And going to have to hold you there. We can talk a little bit later. Debbie, I apologize. Call back right after the bottom of the hour, and I'll make you at the top of the list. This is KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas. Howard Garrett's next.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
But as you know, if you've been listening for very long, don't dial right this second, because this is a portion of the show where we spend a little time talking to one of the best garden experts in this great country of ours, and that would be the Dirt Doctor, the man who is also known as Mr. Howard Garrett. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning, and how is everyone?
It is an absolutely gorgeous day down here. This is turning into a pretty spring. We still seem to be missing some of the rains that you lucky North Texas people are getting, but it's just a beautiful spring. I was thinking, this morning, I rarely have seen a spring when things like the roses are as pretty as they are, both plant-wise, flower-wise, seeing very little black spots, still seeing a little rosette on the susceptible varieties, but just a pretty spring down here. What about you guys?
It's the same way. The rain has been nicely spread out, like we've talked before, with a lot of sunshine in between, and you can watch the plants grow when you get that kind of condition. It's pretty amazing.
It really has been, and one thing we're having to tell people is, don't be too impatient patient. I don't know about you guys, but our soil is still cool, and a lot of perennials that are going to come back haven't started. Even Roberta was giving up on some plumbago that she thought had just frozen and died, but started digging and found out, lo and behold, they were just starting to really break out, putting on new shoots and roots and things down under the mulch and in the soil. So telling people, you know, don't give up on your Esperanza, your Pride of Barbados, your plumbago, and some of the other things like that. They're just, things are a little slow coming out with some of the perennials for us, at least.
Yeah, I'm seeing the same thing. I've got some umbrella plant, the cypress, however you want to pronounce it, and it's really slow coming out. I noticed it coming out this morning because Nellie was overeating some of it as it was coming out of the ground. She was walking around grazing on different things. She was grazing on the black and blue salvia and the little umbrella plant. And one of her favorites, I've got dwarf bamboo.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of interesting. It doesn't grow over 8 inches tall.
Oh, wow.
And I planted it years ago, and it kind of died out in some areas, and then it came back like gangbusters, and I've just encouraged it in one area. And it's her favorite plant in the garden to graze on. She usually throws it up later on, but not always.
That's what Dr. I'm sorry, that's what Dr. Kirby calls dietary indiscretion, where it may taste good going down, but probably not so good coming back up. But, yeah, dietary indiscretion is a very common issue with certain puppy dogs. But I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah, she loves to graze on stuff out there. Did y'all enjoy the eclipse as much as I did? That was one thing that happened that greatly outran my expectations. I was really impressed with what we had here.
Well, we were kind of underwhelmed, I guess you might say. It was cloudy enough here that periodically you would get just a little glimpse of the sun through the clouds, and it was interesting in that, you know, it got to really, really dark. I mean, not black dark, but we saw very little of the sun during the eclipse, and it wasn't all bad. We got to see this in Portland a few years ago and actually watched the sun through our glasses diminish. But I'm glad y'all escaped the cloud cover. It was pretty dense down here.
Well, we had cloud cover, and I thought we were going to have the same effect that apparently y'all had. But just before 100% eclipse, the clouds just parted, and we had just a perfect view of it, and it was spectacular. I did not know you were able to look at it with your naked, bare eyes at full eclipse, but you are, and the ring around it, instead of being yellow like I expected, was just pure white.
Huh.
And then as soon as it starts peering out again, one little speck of the direct sun starts coming back again. You can't look at it. It just, you know, blinds
sure.
you.
Sure.
But, yeah, we lucked out. We had what I was not expecting to see. And I got some video. Maggie hadn't had time, I don't guess, to get it on the website yet. We were going to put it up as a column in the website entry also. And I took some shots of it going through partial eclipse, just a panorama of my garden, and showing the light going down. But when it was at full eclipse, it got dark, and I got it on video. The whole thing is
coming. Oh, well, I'll look forward to seeing that.
And Nellie was running around. I even commented on it on the video. She was running around like nothing was going on. It didn't scare the tater Nellie at all.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people said they saw birds flying back to nest, you know, being confused about that. And there may have been some of that going on, but I didn't detect any unusual animal activity, really.
Well, it was brief. We were sitting out watching it, and didn't have as much hummingbird activity while it was going on. They apparently went somewhere else. But did you get to see the weird shadows? It wasn't bright enough for us, but our manager, Wendy, and her son were out in West Texas, and she brought back some pictures. And I have no idea what creates that, but the shadows that are cast by the partially eclipsed sun are just unusual. I don't even know how to describe them. It's just very kind of bold, black and white, clearly defined things. But did you get to see any of that?
Yeah, not only I got photographs of it, and it's being the videos.
Yeah.
We'll have when we get it done. I'll send you a couple of them that I did that were on the deck here at the pool. But yeah, pretty spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun stuff.
Do you know what causes that? I guess I need a good meteorologist or someone more familiar with things, but it's just very unusual. And of course, physics was not my best subject in school, I'll be the first to admit, but I don't know what accounts for that.
Well, I'll send you mine, and also at least the last video. Yeah, I've got the volume up here, I need to stop that, but I don't know. It's just the way, when it's a partial eclipse, the way the light goes through the foliage, it creates that somehow. I'm not sure how it works either, but it's pretty neat. We had a partial eclipse, what was it, 8 or 10 years ago, I guess, and I got photographs of that, but it happened with this, too, when it was just in partial eclipse. Didn't happen, of course, when it's in full eclipse. It's dark. One thing that I had been told that didn't happen is the sky going completely dark and seeing all the stars. I could see a few of the stars, really bright stars, one or two, but that was it.
And we were the same way. I thought it was interesting. They were saying you might see a comet, you might see solar eruptions, and I think that was wishful thinking or just speculation on the part of somebody that didn't know what they were talking about. One thing that I haven't had a chance to look at yet, but somebody was telling me that there's a website you can go to that's something about the eclipse as viewed from space, and said it's a really interesting, you know, some pictures of, you know, how light moves through space. And again, I can't comment about it until I look at it, but two or three people who did look at it said it was very much worth seeing and gave you a different perspective of how an eclipse occurs. So it might be something to look at. I intend to.
How eclipse moves through space? Is
that, or I think it's eclipse is as viewed from space.
As viewed.
And I guess it was, you know, taken from one of the telescopes or, you know, one of the many pieces of junk we've got floating around in the sky. But again, like I say, I'm not even going to think about talking about something that I haven't seen. But they said it was just a real interesting perspective, and they felt like it gave them a little bit better view of exactly how the eclipse happened. We all know that it's just the moon's shadow passing over the sun, but apparently there's more to it than that.
Cool. You could see didn't even notice it right first, but people told me about it later, and then it occurred to me I had seen the same thing. You could see a flare, a total eclipse. You could see a big flare coming out of the side of the sun that showed up. It was worth seeing. I'm sorry y'all had a cloudy day. I was afraid that was going to be the case for everybody, but for some reason, and somebody also told me that the eclipse itself can help scatter the clouds. I don't know how that would work either, but that was at least mentioned to me by a couple of people. And it didn't get completely uncloudy. We just had a great big hole that formed in the clouds where the sun was.
Well, I guess you were meant to see it. I guess we'll just have to stay healthy for another 20 or 30 years, and we'll get to see it again.
Is that when it comes back? Is it that quick? I thought it was longer than that.
I think it's 2040 or something like that, and golly, the way time passes, that seems like that'll probably be tomorrow. I could be wrong about that, but I was thinking I'd heard 2045 or 2044 or something like that, that there'd be at least something of an eclipse. I don't know if it'll be totality, but Not going to be, you know, way, way, way out in the future. And I'm thinking back that I think it was probably about 12 or 15 years ago was the last one. But it just fascinates me how the astronomers and all can predict pretty much to the minute when eclipses are going to be years in advance, centuries in advance. That takes a three-dimensional brain and knowledge that somehow escapes me. I think I'm a two-dimensional person in a three-dimensional world, but how they can predict both solar and lunar eclipses and tell you exactly when they're going to occur for the next 30 years.
How you can have that much math and physics expertise beats me. I can't even add very well.
Yep, believe me, I know the feeling. Unfortunately, we have a few other talents, I like to think, but the physics and math, I tell you, I was the biology guy, and you were probably the same way. Nature is just so endlessly fascinating, and I love the background that I got in school that helps me understand what I'm looking at. But you know, I can't go sit in the garden without finding something that's just really breathtaking one way or another.
Well, I've got a new tea to tell you about. Maybe I mentioned it to you last week, but did I talk about the tea that I'm making that Logan taught me about, made from pineapple?
Yeah, I think you mentioned it, but we really didn't have a chance to talk about it. So please tell us all about it. I love pineapple and I love tea. So how do you combine the two?
Well, I don't know where she ran into it, but what it is, it's not the pineapple fruit meat at all. It's the rind. Huh. And you just cut the rind off and keep it and boil it, bring it to a boil, and then use that as a base to mix with other ingredients, other teas, other various herbal ingredients if you want to. I've just been drinking it by itself. I'll dilute it down, and it's very refreshing. It has a pineapple flavor. I asked Logan how she cleaned it, and she said, Dad, I didn't. I don't know how you do that. Just buy organic. I just scrubbed it a little bit with my hands, you know, a little bit of friction and and water. But maybe the boiling takes care of anything. But if anybody else has any information about that, listen out there, let us know. I haven't been able to find much info on it, but there's apparently something about it that helps you with inflammation and with various, you know, medicinal kinds of things. Plus, it tastes really good and can be used as a base to mix other things into it. So give it a whirl.
It sounds like something fun to try. I unfortunately this week had a chance to remind myself how good comfrey is when bad things happen. I wasn't looking, didn't even think to shake, but took the towel off the rack as I got out of the shower and got zapped a couple of times by a red wasp. And you know, thank goodness for comfrey. And it took the pain, pain away from it almost instantly. It was still sore to the touch for a few hours afterwards, but I do not like red wasps. I tolerate the yellow jackets. I tolerate the, you know, red and black wasps. But those solid red ones are, they're just bad news in my book. And how on earth this guy got into my towel, I don't know. But it was a very unpleasant experience.
Yeah, they're really aggressive. I remember when I was a kid, we used to go to a little lake. I actually learned how to water ski behind a fishing boat in this little Pine Ridge Lake. Dad would take us round and around in a circle. It was probably a whole lot more dangerous than any of us realized. You know, not only the stumps in the water, but the water moccasins that were there as well. But one day I was out on a wooden pier, and I sat down, threw my legs over the edge of the pier, and smacked my legs right into a red wasp nest and got stung. I don't know how many times. I got pretty sick. They're rough. They're tough on you. You know, I've had one skin issue where comfrey has not helped me yet, and I'm not giving up. I'm going to keep doing it because it seems to get better every time I do it, and then I forget for a while, and it gets back. But it's a little wart on my finger, my index finger of my right hand, mm-hmm. and it's one of those little hard ones that's down under the skin, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The only thing I haven't been able to cure mm-hmm. skin problem-wise with Comfrey. The little crusty things that might be precancerous things and the soft moles and mm-hmm. discoloration, you know, dark spots and things, all of that you can, especially if you do a combination of hydrogen peroxide and the Comfrey.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
But that little hard seed cancer or whatever people, whatever the technical name really is, yeah, they are tough to get rid of.
Well, and yeah, I'm with you. I had the same thing actually on the outside of my little finger, and I'd had something similar to that on the inside before, and finally went to my dermatologist, and he actually took it off, and, you know, once again, they have a long, long name for it, but a little bit of liquid nitrogen took care of it. But I wonder, and again, you know, when these happen in the middle of spring, I'm not going to have a chance to really try many different things, but we're getting several different varieties of Comfrey. Some of them, I think, are more ornamental. They flower better. The flower color varies all the way from pink to white to purple. And it would be interesting to know if, you know, if there is any difference in the medicinal properties of some of the different varieties, because there's a lot more than just one type of Comfrey these days. And I don't know if we've ever talked about it. The other thing that I'm happy about is that our friend Rhonda Bone with Rhonda's Nature's Way here carries a salve where, you know, the Comfrey juice is compounded, probably with lanolin or things like that. So sometimes middle of the winter when it's hard to find, you know, Comfrey out of the garden, you can actually get a Comfrey made with natural things that in the form of a salve that you can put on if you aren't able to run out in the garden and harvest a fresh leaf, which is what I really like to do.
Yeah, if anybody doesn't have Comfrey growing in their vegetable garden and or in their landscaping, they really should, because it's a pretty plant in addition to being a great help. So.
And pretty flowers on it. This one variety, you know, big heads of flowers and just almost continually through the summer months. So, yeah, it's a fun plant. We picked up a variegated form of that when I made a trip to Philadelphia a few years ago, but I think the variegated form doesn't tolerate our heat as well, and it didn't survive real well in the summer down here. But the green Comfrey is amazingly perennial. I think I finally lost it. I probably let it get a little bit dry in 2021, and when we got down in the single-digit temperatures, it didn't come back that winter. But in my garden, it's been perennial, you know, 19 out of 20 years.
Yeah, I've never lost mine. I've got a tough one. You know, variegated plants are interesting. For the most part, the variegated plants tend to be not as hardy, not as tough. Mm-hmm. But there's one plant that the variegated form is tougher than the green form, in my experience, and that's variegated pittosporum. Has lasted through, you know, bitter winters and things like that better than the green form.
That's interesting. I haven't really grown that much variegated pit, but you know, that's still a plant I really like, both the variegated form and the green. Not as crazy about the dwarf form because it's so brittle and doesn't stand up to puppy dog tails or, you know, much of anything else. It tends to, for me, it's always tended to have a little bit more broken foliage and things in it. But pittosporum's been around a long time. I love the smell of the flowers in the spring. And anyway, it's a very good plant. Another thing I was going to tell you about, and excuse me just one second here. Wendy, would you check Axel, please?
Okay.
I know you like Angelonia, which I think is just a wonderful little annual, but there is a new form, and I don't know if it's a Proven Winners or which one it is, but it is a cranberry color, and it is the richest color I've ever seen in Angelonia. And it'll be interesting to see how it goes through the summer months, but if you want something that's really, really striking, take a look at at it in the nurseries when you're out shopping, because it's a pretty new thing. Again, we'll see how hardy it turns out to be, but it's the most intense color that I've ever seen in Angeloni, and certainly worth looking for.
Sounds good. I haven't tried that yet.
I suspect it's a little bit more expensive because our growers only producing it in 6-inch pots. There are some of these newer varieties that they just can't sell it for the price they have to make ends meet. Putting it in the 4-inch containers and selling it by the flats. But probably within a year or two, we'll see more of it. But I really look forward to trying it this year because it's just one of those colors that you just don't see in flowers very often. And when you're just, I'm sure, like me, when you've seen as many different things as we have over the years, when you see something totally new and different, it just really catches your eye.
Yeah, I love to try new things like that. I just sent you a video of the darkness from the eclipse happening, and then you'll also be getting a couple photographs of that interesting shadow pattern on the ground.
I will look forward to that. I will very much look forward to that. Well, anything else special or interesting going on up in your part of the world? I was fascinated, with your talking about all the beautiful things that you saw going out to see Bo and Logan the other day. And Wendy came back with pictures of the same sorts of things that she and her son saw out in Big Bend. And this is just in the high desert. It's just been a beautiful spring for them as well. The blooms on the Ocotillo and the cacti and a lot of these things that don't tolerate having the occasional long periods of rain. I know a few years ago somebody in the San Antonio Parks Department or whatever, they planted Ocotillo all over the place, in different areas. And then we got one of those sessions where it settled in and rained every day for about 2 weeks, and every one of them died. So it's still one of those things you have to go a little further away to see at its peak. But apparently it's been a beautiful, beautiful spring in the desert as well as in town.
I think, yeah, it's as good a year this year as it has been in a long time. I love the desert. That's Sonoran Desert, and they've had a lot of rain out there this year up to this point. Mm-hmm. And probably the color is better than it's been in a long time.
Well, Sonoran Desert and the Chihuahuan Desert both. I don't know. Of course, they're up a little bit higher altitude and probably don't have the intense heat. But I love my summers in the wildlife management area in West Texas. And, of course, I spent some of my growing up years out in Albuquerque. But desert has a beauty all its own. And it's just a unique group of creatures that live in it, all the way from the insects to the reptiles and some of the unusual desert geckos. Like I say, I don't think I'd want to live in it 365 days a year anymore, but still a fun place to visit, and the spring and the fall are definitely the times to go see it.
And I warn everybody about one plant, and I don't know why nature did this to us, but the walking cholla is a nasty booger. Ooh. And I think the thing has the ability to throw thorns at you, because I'm really careful when I'm around that stuff. It's a pretty plant.
Yeah.
But, boy, if you get hit with that stuff, it is not fun.
Well, just be glad that we have an opposable thumb and you can get it out, because, it's sort of off-weighted, and however Mother Nature design that, it will literally walk up your leg, because it sticks in one point, but then when you take a step, the bottom end of it comes free and it jumps up and sticks in you, and with each step that bottom comes loose and it will literally walk up your leg. And I don't know that it's the worst thing I've encountered. We have a little cactus they call Tasajillo or something like that is pretty vicious as well, but it just reminds you to be careful where you step, that's for sure.
Well, I'll tell you, when we were walking around, I was just super careful about not bumping into it, and I ended up getting some in my hand somehow or another, and how I did it, I don't have any idea.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I always like to tell people, and we can tell our audience, is if you're handling cacti, The big thorns will certainly poke you and make you bleed, but those little thorns called glaucidia that are typically at the base of the big thorns on Opuntia and some of that type of cacti, they can just be, you know, murderous on your hands and all. But if you get a real sticky piece of tape, Gorilla tape or whatever else, and put over it and rub it down, and then just rip it off with a quick motion, it'll take them out almost 100%. Takes a little bit of hair and a few other things as well, but anybody that you know, that grabs some of these so-called thornless plants, and it only means they don't have the big spines. It doesn't mean they don't have the little glaucidia to get you, but anybody that's gotten into them, you'll thank me for that piece of information as to how to get them out instead of trying to pick them out one thorn at a time with a pair of tweezers.
Yeah, and that Gorilla tape is the best. That stuff is really, really strong. It's serious tape. And, you know, the spineless, like you say, the spineless cactus, the spineless prickly pear, that's the worst one, because you don't think about it being a problem, and before you know it, you've got all those tiny little spines all in you.
And while we're talking about those products, it's probably worth mentioning a beautiful little golden retriever. Well, he's not little anymore, just came through the door. Mr. Axel's lying here chewing on something, but the Gorilla Glue, which is also, you know, a really good glue, but boy, keep it away from your dogs, because apparently it tastes good. And several years ago, I was visiting, I go by Dr. Kirby's clinic on a regular basis just to see what's going on over there, and he had just operated on a dog successfully, but this puppy dog had gotten hold of its daddy's container of Gorilla Glue. And you know how it expands when it hardens? It had literally filled up the dog's stomach and hardened. And Dan, being the incredible surgeon he is, he, you know, opened the stomach. He had to break it into pieces to get it out. And, the pieces ought to be in vet school somewhere, because it was a perfect cast of the lining of the stomach, the rugae, the belly, the things like that that your stomach is lined with. And actually, the dog survived thanks to his incredible surgical skills. But apparently, it's something that if you leave out, you know, a dog will get into it and eat it if they can. And the results are not often as good as they were when you have Dr. Kirby for your vet.
Yeah, that's a good tip. You know, they make several of them. And one of the things that I've learned working with Gorilla Glue on some of my art frames and things like that, some of the Gorilla Glues expand and some of them don't. In fact,
really?
The most powerful one is called something like Super Glue, Gorilla Super Glue or something like that. It's the most expensive, very expensive. You buy real small little containers of it, because you don't need but a drop or two and it holds things like they've been welded together. It's really powerful. But the ones that are less expensive that come in bigger containers, which is probably what the dog you're talking about got into, they're the ones that will expand quite quite a bit.
Well, that's good to know. I didn't know that. And everybody has things they have to glue periodically, but that's, you know, when we find a good product, I sure don't mind talking about it, because it's everybody has things break every now and then, and to be able to find something that will adhere to many different surfaces, and I wasn't familiar with this. The only ones I've seen are these epoxy type products that are a mess to have to mix and pretty hard. If there's a different Gorilla Glue that works that well, I'll sure be looking for it. And the other reason to of course, by the smaller containers, is that hopefully you don't need to use a whole container at one time, and it does not have a long shelf life. Even when you're careful to get that top back on it, it's not too long before you'll try to get some out and realize you better go buy a new tube of it.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there's three or four different kinds. There's a white Gorilla Glue, and there's different ones. I forget all the names, but the thing to remember is the most expensive one that comes in the smallest containers usually is the one called Super Glue. That's the best.
That's good to know.
It probably is dangerous. You know, if pets got into it too, just like the other stuff, but it does work.
Yeah. The other thing that I'll mention quickly that I had not seen before is they are also making a clear tape now where you're using, where you don't want to have the tape quite as visible. Gorilla's making a clear tape that's kind of like the old cellophane tape that doesn't have the usual, you know, black or whatever color. We use the yellow form to put on steps because, you know, just for safety reasons. But sure. I just saw the clear tape the other day. It was the first time I've seen it. I'm sure we'll find plenty of uses for it as well. Well, Howard is always... Go ahead.
I'm still working on my bamboo control. I'm still in the window for that. But other than that, enjoying the pretty garden. Everybody do the same. Enjoy those healthy gardens out there.
Well, and we'll be watching DirtDoctor.com for some more clips, pictures. And as always, thank you so much for taking a little of your Saturday morning with us. And I think we'll just have to do it again next week.
Sounds like a good idea. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Howard. Everybody enjoy those gardens and listen for our segment with Howard Garrett, which we do about 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. And remember that DirtDoctor.com is the best website for accurate information you'll find on the web anywhere. Don, let's get a break in here and maybe take a few more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening here, and let's see. Oh, gosh, looks like we've got Charlie and John and Shorty. That'll probably take us through the rest of the show. Good morning, Charlie.
Hi, good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning.
Question on a Salvia greggii. Planted, I think, 2 weekends ago.
Okay.
And the red flowers are, you know, it blooms, and then the flowers turn white.
Are they fully white or are they partially white?
Partially white.
Okay, that is a variety of Salvia greggii called Hot Lips. I guess after okay. Hot Lips Houlihan or whoever, but that
MASH,
you know that
yeah, from MASH.
Yeah, that's probably not where the name came from, but that variety of Salvia greggii is actually called Hot Lips, and sometimes you'll have solid white flowers, sometimes you'll have solid red flowers, but generally under good conditions, the flowers will be like half red and half white. So I think you're just looking at a more unusual variety than you're used to. There's also a new one out that is two-tone that's a little bit richer colors. It's just gorgeous. I love Salvia greggii.
Yeah, I got the reds and then the really pink ones. So, beautiful colors.
Yeah, there's an orange one I think they call Salsa. There's a pure white one, and just within the past year, they've come out with some of these two-tone ones. Hot Lips has been around for about 3 years now, but there's some new ones out there, and they all seem to be super cold-hardy, evergreen, drought-tolerant once established, just a good choice for our gardens. Take no such thing as too much sun for them.
Right. Okay, yep, they're getting the sun. So, Sagal Palm. The top froze, you know, that came out of the stump, the top of the stump. You know, there's some undergrowth palm fronds. If that top one comes out, do those undergrowth ones, are they taking away nutrients from the top of the plant?
No, not really. And, you know, it's weird. The sagos have taken it hard 3 years in a row now. And what is so difficult on this year's damage is that it's not like the whole frond is damaged. Just like, you know, two-thirds of the frond is frozen back, but a third of it's green, and you want to leave all the green you can just to support the plant while it gets over the damage. But if you really want to make them look nice until their new spring growth comes out, it's a tedious process to get in there with your little fine-nose shears and cut the brown off, because I don't recommend just lopping the whole frond off like you can, you know, where the entire frond is either damaged or undamaged. But sagos have had a rough time.
Yeah, they've frozen back, like you said, the last 3 years. Yeah, and the top fronds, the whole things are brown, so I'm going to go out and cut them all the way back.
Oh, yeah, by all means do so.
Yeah, try not to get poked too many times.
Well, and above all, wear eye protection. You can get over poking your fingers, but you don't want to get it in your face.
Right. And on your eclipse shadows, mm-hmm. all the leaves in the trees, they're overlapping each other. So they're each, so all that overlaps, creating little pinholes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you need. You need the little pinholes to create the shadow. Otherwise, you won't see it because you don't have the pinholes. So it's just a lot of pinholes, essentially, that all the leaves are creating that create all those, the crescent. You'll see a lot of all that crescent.
All the
crescent image of the moon partially eclipsing the sun. So that's it goes back to the camera obscura from, I think, Da Vinci. Little pinhole colanders, the kitchen colanders do the same thing. That's why a lot of people say that, because it has all those holes on it. And if you can do the same thing holding a colander over a white surface, so you can see.
Interesting. Well, you're a physicist as well as a good gardener, so thanks for sharing. And have a good weekend, and I do appreciate it. We'll talk again, Charlie. Don, let's get our last break in here so we'll know how much time we have, and talk to John and Shorty.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. Well, that worked out pretty well. I think we'll have time to get both John and Shorty in. John is first in line. Good morning, John.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Bob.
Morning.
Quick question, hopefully. I have one oak tree in the front lawn. This is a weird situation. The half of the yard closest to the street is blooming with Bermuda. I had some clovers in it, so I spread some weed and seed. And then the back half closest to the house, it was all clovers. So, and then under that was just hard dirt. So, I went and tilled it, and I spread some seed. It's going on 3 weeks now. And there's nothing growing on that back, but on the front half, it took. So I'm trying to see what remedies are out there.
Just be patient. Clover's going to die out as soon as it gets hot. And weed and feed, overuse it, and you'll kill your trees out there. It's a horrible product and a known cancer causer as well. And the reason you've got the clover is because the soil is so hard, and clover is one of the few plants whose roots will actually penetrate that soil. And the clover, Mother Nature has put it there to work on softening the soil. So it's going to die out, like it or not, as the weather gets hotter. Best thing you can possibly do is put a thin layer of compost over it, and probably a little extra molasses, either dry or liquid, because that's going to work up the or greatly bump up the microbial activity, which is what's going to work at softening the soil. Old Malcolm Beck, he planted something called Hubam clover, which grows about 5 feet tall. The seed is very expensive. He planted it, and this stuff literally got head high, and boy, he had dollar signs in his eyes. But one of the wise old timers around here just said, Malcolm, that's the tallest you will ever see that clover because of how it's going to improve your soil this year. And sure enough, the next year it came back and only grew like a foot tall. So clover is not necessarily a bad thing, and it's not going to be there permanently. It's going to go away when the weather gets hotter. So at this point, I'd tell you just, fertilize, put out some compost, and your lawn grass, be it Bermuda or St. Augustine, will dominate the clover, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. That's Mother Nature's natural soil softener. So be a little patient with it, and your grass will dominate.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. I was about to go buy another bag, and I said,
No. It's, I'm sitting here with our new puppy just thinking about, Dr. Kirby always says when he has dogs come in with life-ending cancers, the first thing he asks the people is, do you use weed and feed? And the answer is always yes. So try to stay away from it, except in real extreme conditions.
Sounds good. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you, sir. Thank you very much. And let's move along to Shorty. Good morning, Shorty.
Yes, sir. Bob, I'm wanting to plant some out in the front of my house.
I have big, I want to do it outside. And I have that South Texas black gumbo. Mm-hmm. Would you recommend digging some of that out and putting some sandy loam in there before I plant, or what would you recommend I do?
Well,
we've planted them in the past, and they didn't survive, and I don't know if we wasn't doing it right or what.
Yeah, your phone was cutting out. So what is it you want to plant in this black gumbo?
Yeah, the knockout roses.
Oh, knockout roses. Knockout roses, you don't want to work too hard on improving the soil, because then your roses don't want to grow, you know, they don't really want to grow a big root system. They just want to grow in the improved portion of what you've done, and they don't get very drought tolerant that way, and then they really suffer in the hot summer months. I would consider creating a bit of a raised bed. If you don't actually want to do a raised bed, do just a berm. Just, you know, build the soil up 18 inches or so with a better soil and with plenty of compost in it, which will soften the soil underneath it, and plant your knockouts in there. If you dig down to that gumbo and plant them, it's just going to be like being in a great big pot, and they won't ever get really well established. So, and it's just not practical, of course, take a backhoe and replace everything out there. But if you can build it up either, you know, with something to retain the soil, or literally just mound it up on top of it with a better soil rich in compost, your knockouts will do well. The compost in the material will soften the soil underneath it to where the rose roots will start penetrating that, and you'll end up with good, healthy plants and lots of beautiful flowers.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. And how should I fertilize them after I first plant them, or put fertilizer in the bottom of the hole, or what?
You should do both. When you're using organic fertilizers, it doesn't have to be watered in. There's no danger of burning. So I would mix some in the soil when you plant. I would follow up with a good mulch on the surface and a little bit more. And I think you also would be good to use some liquid fertilizer as well as dry to really get them well established. And you'll have a beautiful bed to show for it.
Okay. Thank you, Bob, very much.
I appreciate it, Shorty. You're certainly welcome. Thank you. Everybody else, let's do it again tomorrow morning. We get to talk plants from 8 until 11, and then Dr. Kirby comes in, and we talk about your pet's health from 11 till noon. Right now, it's time for Martin Bomba, and probably Jim be with him this morning, and you can get all your home improvement questions answered just by leaving with that dial where it is on KTSA Radio, AM 550 in San Antonio, Texas.